framework bill is supposed to be a less prescriptive. And the municipalities, therefore, are saying you shouldn't interfere with our area. I'm not passing judgment because I'm not a drafter. I'm not a drafter. I have an understanding that a framework bill should be a little big, should give guidance, and the practitioners should interpret what was in the brain of the legislator. But let's check, because we have been told there were sections of this bill that are contradicting the Municipal Systems Act, and some of them taking over the clauses of the Municipal Structures Act. We will then have to deal with that, because the intention of the law is to facilitate, it is not to frustrate. Can we get some questions from the members? I'm not guiding you to ask the questions relevant to what I've just said. I'm just breaking the ice a little bit. Honourable members, this is your opportunity. The department be ready, because there are certain things that I think you should respond to here. Maybe the lawyers will not be here to hear what the presenters are saying. Honorable Ngwenya Mabila.
Thank you, Chairperson. My first two questions will be based on to Selda. They've said something about the definition of engineering, that it is too narrow. Maybe if you can just unpack what is it that you're expecting from this definition, because so that we understand it correctly. Then the other one, you've raised a concern that for the reviewal to be done after each and every 5 years, it will not be feasible, and also it will be expensive, but they didn't indicate the specific term. What is their input? When do you want the reviewal to be done, if you see that doing it in 5 years' time will not be feasible, and also it will be expensive? Then the other one, Chair, I think it's Tshwane, because it talks of the interference by provinces. Maybe can they just indicate that how do they see, doesn't they see it as the intergovernmental relation, because the bill tries to involve all these spheres of government and indicates their roles and responsibility. And also on the issue of the consultation. They've made some comments, but they were not given the feedback. But they are saying this is the second draft. Because according to my understanding, when the bill is being drafted, people have commented. If they don't see their comments on the second draft, I think that they should. It's obvious they should just take as is that their comments were not either they are accommodated in the bill, or they were not considered to be part of the bill. Then the other one, Chair, they indicated the issue of that we cannot have the national and the provincial legislation. Maybe if they can also unpack that, because in most cases we've got national and provincial legislation, but the only matter is that they must not contradict each other. If they contradict each other, the national one supersedes. So if they're saying we need not to have the national and the provincial one, what do they mean by that? The other one was on, which one? The KZN. Etegwini, yes, Etegwini. Whereby they are saying that the bill was supposed to be accompanied by the regulations. I don't think that's supposed to be the case. In most cases, the bill is a bill after it has been enacted into the act, then the minister must come out with the regulation. But maybe if they can clarify to us what do they mean by that, because regulations come after the bill has been passed into the act. And also they talk of the national that the national support and the monitoring must come prior to the implementation of the bill. I understand the support, but the monitoring, because while you are busy implementing, you have to monitor. Monitoring is continuous. So if they're saying monitoring also must come before the implementation of the bill, I think the support, I understand, but monitoring must be continuous when the bill is being implemented. On this appeal, Chief President, maybe if you can just be clarified, because others are saying municipalities don't have the capacity, talking of the outside people, others are talking of that it needs to be composed of the internal people. Just can we just get a clarity on this one? Thank you, Chief President.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'd like to preface my question with an observation. Now that we've had a couple of municipalities come and make presentations, that there appear to be a lot of issues of mutual concern at local government level, and a lot of confusion arising from the proposed legislation and existing legislation that determines how municipalities work, both in the Systems and Structures Act. And I'd like to ask the department, or Mr. Ogunrobe, to explain to us why there seems to be this consistent thread of concern from local governments and SALGA around these common issues, because they've made submissions before, and if they made them before, why were they not taken into account? Many presenters said a lot of their submissions were considered and put into the new proposed legislation, but many of these common issues, commonalities, continue to crop up, so I'd like to know why that is so. And then with the presenter from the city of Etekwini, he started his presentation by saying, making reference to Chapter 3, and he was highlighting the issue that necessary support and capacitation will have to be put in place before the implementation of SLUM. Could I get an idea of what kind of necessary support and capacitation? Because it's almost impossible to say that you can enact legislation as long as you give me the necessary means. I understand unfunded mandates, but you can't have people saying, we'll consider your legislation and if you give us adequate capacitation, because that could take decades to adequately capacitate.
There being no further question, I will give this time to municipalities and SALGA. Oh, you want the department to start first? Yeah, I saw your hand. I thought you wanted to start first.
Honorable Chair, I just wanted to add another question of clarity. Just to ask SALGA how they expect maybe national or our department in particular to repeal legislation that we do not necessarily administer, because the pieces of legislation that they quoted, like for example Lefty, is being administered by the Department of Human Settlements, and then the other one, the Act 70 of 70, by the Department of Agriculture, and then the other legislation, then with provincial legislation, which we are not in the position to repeal as a national department.
Thank you. disparities first. You go first, Chief.
Well, when we hear from the Minister, but maybe just to respond to that, it's not necessarily the Department that repeals those legislation, it's Parliament that repeals it. So, it's not to say that we don't care who repeals it in the end. We sit with the problem that we sit with all these different pieces of legislation in the end. Still. Yes, it's, maybe I'm speaking to it, yeah. So, Parliament must repeal these acts, whether it's different national departments that deal with this respective legislation. We must know where we stand with these different sets of legislation.
Just for your interest, Joburg, the Department of Justice has been asked by Parliament to review all archaic laws that have an impact not only on disparities but on development in general and the administration of justice. We're still waiting for that list, but you are pointing out at particular pieces of legislation that that may confuse implementation of SPLAP. Maybe we'll take it up with our counterparts in the Portfolio Committee of Justice, maybe in agriculture as well, so that we can look at how we can cooperate with each other in this regard. I know, I'm sure the department is worried about them interfering with other TEFs, but the law says they must cooperate in order to ensure administration of justice. The laws of the country properly. Tegwin?
Thanks, Chair. In as far as the capacitation issue is concerned, the honourable member is correct. The focus of our submission is around prior capacitation, prior to implementation. We would like to see a more structured process in terms of how that is going to unfold. You've got the municipalities who are going to be implementing the large chunk of this act, so to speak. In as far as the practitioners on the ground, they need to know what to expect and how to interpret the various clauses and provisions of the legislation. So that needs to be explained upfront prior to implementation, as an example. You've got the private sector practitioners who are supposed to be interacting with the different spheres of government dealing with different types of submissions. They need to be clear what the different clauses and provisions mean. You've got the provinces. Some who have their own planning legislation currently, some who have their proposed legislations currently being worked on at the moment. What does this process mean at a national level in relation to what is currently in place or what is currently being proposed at a provincial level, so that you eliminate confusion sooner rather than later? So all we're suggesting is that maybe prior to the enactment of the Act, maybe the National Department, we want to see from them a deliberate effort and a more structured process as a way of capacitating all of us to avoid any areas of confusion. And as far as the regulations are concerned,
can I help you in one little bit? Yes, I have no intention of disrupting flow ideas. Are you not aware of what SALGA just claimed here? SALGA is saying they and the department are currently engaging municipalities in exactly what you're talking about. I'm surprised that Tegwini would not know that.
Yes, Chair, the SALGA process so far has only been focusing on a coordination of input as a response to this proposed legislation. We're not at a stage yet where we say, right, These are the areas that we accept, as far as the national bill is concerned, and how we're going to be dealing with this from an implementation and practical, at a practical level. Now, as far as the regulations are concerned, yes, in terms of process, you enact legislation and then you have regulations. But our experiences have been that regulations take too long to come about. And then that vacuum, it does lead to some level of confusion, mostly. So we, if possible, we would like to see a situation where maybe in parallel, whilst the national act is being enacted, regulations are also released sooner rather than later, so that you close that gap, which will then breed confusion. Thank you, Chair.
Before you leave the platform, there has been a number of municipalities and practitioners who suggest that the bill does suggest transitional mechanisms to close the gap. But they were talking about their concern about overlapping and parallel processes. But would you comment on this transitional arrangement that has been suggested in the bill? If you're asking for the closing of the gap between the Act coming on and the removal of the existing laws, that's your concern, but I'm saying if your concern is not addressed by the transitional arrangement.
The transitional arrangements, in as much as Section 60 attempts to deal with that, we offer the view that needs to be covered and expanded on. As far as that is concerned, for example, at a practical level, just besides the potential constitutionality issues that the other municipalities have raised, the bill is silent on how we're going to be dealing with applications at a practical level, which are going to be caught between the old and the new order, so to speak.
Thank you, Tegwini. We'll move on to the bulk of the questions were directed at SALGA as well. Swali, come along.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The questions that were directed at Swani is, as the first one is the intergovernmental roles and responsibilities, because we made a submission that we're concerned about interference from a provincial level. Now, these comments were directed specifically at Schedule 1, which sets out the matters on which the provinces may legislate. And if you look at the clauses that we've listed in our presentation, those powers are so wide as to almost reinvent the institutional arrangements within the municipalities, the administrative procedures that are going to be included in that process. Now, we can only give our comments in light of the current draft provincial legislation. And if you look at that legislation, that's exactly what we're concerned about, because, for instance, the decision maker is specified in that legislation, being that the municipal manager must do certain things. Now, the administration in terms of which a local government operates should be our decision. In other words, we decide the manner in which the institutional arrangements are being done and the delegations that are granted in terms of local government. We do not believe that it's necessary to legislate this at national or provincial level because of the Municipal Systems Act putting these structures into place. So that was the context in which we were concerned about the interference. The other issue around Schedule 1 is that the Municipal Systems Act allows for a local government to do a spatial development framework. This act is going to allow for a local authority to do a spatial development framework, and so does the provincial legislation. None of these have the same content. So So local authorities are going to find themselves in a situation where you have to comply with the MSA, you're going to have to comply with the SPLUMP, you're going to have to comply with the provincial legislation when you do your spatial development framework, none of which the content are the same. So those are the things we're worried about, because that's what's going to create conflict and what's going to prevail. So that was the context in which we made those comments. With regard to the consultation, our concern with the consultation is, yes, we've provided comments, and obviously it's within the sole preserve of the department whether to accept those comments or not. Our problem is that there are commonalities that are coming out from local government. There are mutual concerns. It means that there must be a need for this to be addressed in the bill. Otherwise, they would not have been raised by all the municipalities, including SALGA. So, in as far as the consultation is concerned, we want some feedback as to know, then, if this is a mutual concern from local government, why is it not addressed? There might be a very good reason why it wasn't addressed, because there's a different view. And once that view has been explained, we might say, okay, now we understand why it wasn't addressed. But as long as those common concerns stand and we don't get any feedback, it's just going to make the legislation impossible to implement. Just on the last question around the national provincial legislation, we have absolutely no problem that there must be national and provincial legislation. We are not saying that you can't have two pieces of legislation. What we are saying is there's a particular section 26 in this bill that says that regardless of any other provisions in any other law, you can do a land use change in terms of this bill. In other words, if there's provincial legislation and this bill allows you to bring an application for land use change in terms of this bill, you have two processes. So as a developer, I can choose. Do I use the provincial legislation or do I use the national legislation? And that will bring us back to the untenable situation where we had the DFA and the provincial legislation. So all we're saying is that if you want an alternative for the provinces that do not have provincial legislation, that obviously is acceptable, otherwise you're working in a vacuum. But then say that where there are provincial legislation, that would be the legislation to be used. So that was the comment around specifically saying that you can't have both processes running parallel. And then if I may just add on the repeal, our concern about the repeal legislation is that this bill does not give any status to developments that were done in terms of other legislation, old archaic legislation. If there's something, a provision which says that the township that was established in terms of the Less Formal Township Establishment Act or the Trust Townships or the R293 Townships, it can be dealt with as if it was a township establishment in terms of current provincial or national legislation, then you can move forward with them. But until such time as there's some status given to those developments, we are going to be working in a vacuum and we can't give proper freehold registered properties to their beneficiaries. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
There's a commentator or presenter who said this bill is well and good for Greenfields development, but does not deal with the old established. It's the same thing as what you say. And it's only Section 26 that deals with that.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, but very inadequately. So there must be some status given to these developments. And I think 26 is not the resolution, because 26 only deals with new applications or land use changes. It doesn't deal with current developments that are not within the formal system in terms of registration and planning.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. So, Anne, come, Salga.
Thank you, Chair. I'll just quickly touch the issue of Lefty and the 870 of 1970. I think what Salga was asking, we were asking the question to say, given the fact that this particular bill is coming in as a proposal to have some kind of a coherent framework that regulates planning, how are the pieces of legislation that we are assigned to provinces going to be repealed? We are asking the question. We are saying there is no clarity with regards to that. And we are saying, without clarifying how those pieces of legislation are going to be repealed, we are still going to find ourselves in a situation whereby you've got multiple laws that are regulating the same thing. And we are asking the question, how are those pieces of legislation going to be repealed? If it's going to be repealed by the departments that are, who are going to initiate, who are actually the custodian of those pieces of legislation, that's the question that we're asking. And then when it comes to the issue of the definition of engineering services, our reading of the definition, we are of the view that it does not cover a situation where, for example, the developer is required to provide services with a capacity more than what is required directly with that particular the development proposal. In other words, we are of the view that it's actually there are shortcomings when it comes to providing engineering services that are of a long-term nature. In other words, where a developer is required to provide services that cover, that goes over and above the capacity of his immediate development. And if you read that together with the requirement for, I think there's a reference in the bill to fair and reasonable costs. I think it's section 44 of the, 40, subsection 4 of the bill. We have the view that given the fact that there's no guidance that is given with regard to how one arrives at the fair and reasonable costs, we have the view that it's bound to actually create confusion and would want more guidance to be provided with regard to that. And when you look at the definition of internal engineering services, we are also of the view that it does not cover, for example, private roads, and no provision is made for possible contribution to provincial engineering services where developments have an impact on, say, provincial roads. So that's the context that we're making when we say we think it's a bit narrow. If you look at our detailed submission, you'll see the suggestions that we're making with regards to that, with regards to the whole issue around norms or standards when it comes to the calculation of development contributions. Chair, the question around the review, the five-year review, the point that Salga is making is given our experience with regards to the work that is required and the resources that is required when it comes to the review of the scheme, we are saying our experience has shown us that even with well-resourced municipalities, it's very difficult to do a review of a land use scheme covering the entire municipality every 5 years. We understand maybe the thinking around that was to try and achieve an alignment between your IDP process and your land use schemes and your SDFs, but we are saying 5 yearly review is going to be too onerous. Maybe 10 years, maybe 15 years, we do not have a definitive time period, but we are saying this 5 year review, we are of the same view that it's going to be too onerous for our municipalities. Maybe an approach that looks at a differentiated approach that says, for example, if a municipality is classified as a municipality that is going under high growth rate, maybe you might want a shorter period. For your municipalities where basically nothing is happening, you might want a different approach. But these are the issues that we are saying we need to engage with the department. Let the municipalities give their input with regards to what would be feasible and how can you approach this whole issue of review, and then let us work it into the legislation. We do not have the answers, but we are raising an issue to say it's an area of concern. Thank you, Chair.
ESCOM did make the same point, the last point you were making about the reviewers. They were saying that the SDF of the national government could take 20 years and that of the provincial could take 10. And perhaps that is the reason why the department made 5 years for municipalities. But the point you're making of cost should have been taken into consideration as well. Maybe the department will give us feedback on that at an appropriate moment. I think that appropriate moment is now.
Thanks, Chair. Chair, where in your hand? And thanks, Chair. We will not attempt to justify or defend our positions in respect of all these comments. Many of them are indeed.
Start by dealing with the feedback that the municipalities made the submissions and you never gave them feedback. I'm not suggesting that make a legal argument now because you may end up in court. I suggest that you explain why you did not give them feedback so that they understand whether their comments are taken into account but they were not acceptable or whatever. Just explain why. Why did you not give them feedback?
Chair, with respect, it is not entirely
correct that we did not give feedback. Chair, what we did not do was to do individual responses to comments raised by individual institutions and organizations in the press. In addition to the over 112 written comments that we received, we had several engagements. Indeed, Chair, we submitted a consultation report to the Parliament. There were several hundred, well, maybe a few hundred, more than 100 meetings, apart from written comments that we had across the country. In some provinces, we had over 6 meetings with provincial departments in the space of 3-4 months. It was practically, it will require all machinery of the state to individually. Chair, what we did in many of the engagements we had was to explain and explain. We actually classified the comments. There were many comments which we received from different sources. There were conflicting comments. Even within this past 2 days, we've seen that some of the comments actually are conflicting. So we have documents which we'll share with as many colleagues in government or even outside of government that were interested in how we dealt with many of the comments. But we must say we did not do individual one-on-one responses. Many of the follow-up meetings we had, in this chair, after cabinet approval of the bill, we had several workshops again to report back to colleagues, to keep colleagues in the know as to what exactly would happen. If what colleagues are saying is that we did not do a line-by-line response to each written comments. I mean, people got senior counsel opinion on some of these issues. Some of them will require a whole day's workshop to even explain how we understood, but we applied our minds to each of those comments, Chair. Chair, I think it's also worth saying that as officials, we submitted a bill around March to Cabinet. Cabinet approved the bill, which, I mean, that was the second time now for introduction to Parliament. We did had some robust engagements with many stakeholders post April 2012. We ourselves have become wiser in terms of getting deeper insights into some of the comments raised by colleagues. So it is not also the case that the bill that we have not, after submission to Parliament, even ourselves had cause to reconsider our views on some of them. So we're just saying that at the appropriate time, Chair, as I have stated yesterday, we will ourselves make a presentation on maybe some of those issues that we would want you to look at based on the inputs we've received from colleagues. So it's not entirely that what they have submitted are not acceptable to us. It's also for us to just inform maybe at this junction that since last year we've had engagements at NEDLAC, and I'm not sure where exactly it is right now, but there should be a NEDLAC report coming to Parliament by the Minister on some of the discussions we've had at NEDLAC. Just a few of the issues that were raised in the comments today, Chair. On municipal planning, on possible encroachment on the powers of municipalities or mandates of municipalities, on the possibility that Schedule 1 of this bill may not be entirely correct or legally sound. I would almost say in the past 11 years of engagement with this bill, the appropriate balance of what exactly you locate within the municipal sphere or what sits at the provincial sphere or where the boundary of the national powers stop or start has been very hotly contested, and we will continue to be guided by yourselves. But what we have in Schedule 1 is not that prescriptive. It counts in totally non-mandatory manner. We've said may. And when we've listed those issues, Chair, and I would stand to be corrected, we have not actually said provinces should do those things. The way we understand the Constitution, Chair, is that Schedule 1 to the bill allows provinces, read with Section 10 of the bill as we have it now, Clause 10 allows provinces to make legislation which are consistent with this national one. And we think they will further do, as the Constitution enjoins them to so do, the question of monitoring and supporting municipalities in the effective discharge of their municipal planning mandate. Chair, the worst-case scenario will have been one which says that if you take a different region of the Constitution, which says that municipalities actually don't need national laws or provincial laws to do what they, in any event, are constitutionally vested to do. A municipality that we are aware of has even got legal opinion that they may do bylaws to do some of these issues that we've brought in this national law. The result of that would then mean that we will have over 200 different regulatory regimes in this respect. So our reason of the Constitution is that national government may actually regulate how municipalities exercise their powers. So it is not a case of national descending to the theater to come and exercise these powers, or inviting the provinces to encroach and take away powers of municipalities, but to say that they are indeed constitutional authority for us to come and work with municipalities to ensure that the way and manner in which they exercise their powers are indeed consistent with certain other national objectives as enunciated in the Constitution. So I would just say that Section 10, read with Section 33 of the bill, maybe just to dispose the question of even the possibility of parallel legislation, as alluded to by my colleague from Tuani. I think our intention, and if we've done so, we must quickly retract. It's not to continue post enactment of this legislation to allow different pieces of legislation to prescribe parallel or alternative modes of bringing application. We have not read the bill to propose such a mechanism. And we feel that to the extent that we're saying that provincial laws must be consistent with this law and that all applications should be first brought to a municipality, we do not think it would be legitimate for a province to make a piece of legislation that will allow a parallel process. We do not agree with that reading. Chair, on the question of appeals, there are a couple of things around appeals. I think the first that I would want to address is that of involvement of councillors. In our earlier presentation to this portfolio committee, Chair, you may recall that we stated that there are different voices around whether or not councillors or politicians should be involved, either at the first instance of consideration of applications on land development matter or even at the appellate stage. Chair, the reality is that our view, the proposal in the bill, which we think may not be unanimous but represents the official policy position of government, is that it's to put our councillors at a slightly different higher pedestal to say that they would deal, I think almost like as Mr. Johnson stated, that if you look at the volume of applications in many municipalities, it may not be tenable to expect politicians to receive applications and those kind of things. For the same reason that KZN Cox has stated that indeed there are fewer applications on appeal, we then thought that politicians may have a role to play in appeals after officials and non-officials have had the opportunity of considering the initial matter. To the extent that we have that proposal in the bill, we will continue to be guided by ourselves in whether or not, if we reverse this order, that will be what you prefer. And a reverse also comes from some of the comments where people are saying that, why don't you have the municipality consider it first? Then you take it out on appeal to this independent appeal tribunal of non-officials. I think it may suffer the same criticism students say, that when a municipality has exercised its legitimate authority over a land use matter, non-officials outside of the municipality will then sit in authority to overturn a municipal decision. I think there are flip sides of that argument that we need to then weigh, which one is preferable, a total internal processes with limited external participation, or one which says that we must have total internal consideration but externalize the question of the appeals. So it is in that context that we then want to place in your hands, Chair, the proposals around intermunicipal appeals, whether indeed we will then prefer that model. Chair, provincial legislation, the way we have envisaged it, and the way our engagements have been with most, if not all, the provinces, is that provincial legislation on this subject will indeed be consistent with national law. We will not expect any other possibility in that regard. Chair, just a small comment on the question of different SDFs. Chair, we note the comment around the possibility of possible inconsistency between our SDFs at different spheres of government.
A little bit. I think the last comment you made didn't go far enough to cover. I think the Joburg was one where they say the law is prescriptive in as far as giving provincial government legislation framework to override even existing pieces of legislation. I think it's section, what is it, schedule one? Yes.
Schedule one is says that provinces may legislate. And we read schedule one with section, clause 10 of the bill. Schedule one says provinces may legislate on these matters. We concede that those matters enumerated in schedule one are indeed matters almost squarely within municipal planning. In fact, the bulk of this bill deals with that same subject. But we are saying that we are not inviting provinces to appropriate these powers to themselves. We are saying that to the extent that provinces also have a vested interest in ensuring that their provincial planning mandates, which is constitutionally vested in them, have implications for special planning and land use management. Provincial planning is a competence of provinces. And to the extent that they, indeed, should also define their relationship with municipalities. We think they will be constitutionally inside and not out of and they will not be constitutionally out of order to so regulate. But if we read Schedule 1 together with Clause 10 of the bill, we then see that Clause 10 says that the provincial legislation must indeed be consistent with the national one. So we have a seamless flow of national, provincial, and municipal planning and land use management systems, which flows into each other.
You're speaking as if South Africa is like Europe. All citizens are in agreement with how they go forward. You're not thinking about conditions where there's inter-party rivalry between the province and the local. Are you taking that into consideration as well? Because when it is written in law, the province will say, this is my power. This is my right to exercise it. And the local authority would have absolutely no right to say no. When in fact, if it is allowing the municipality STF to say, this is the route we want to go in terms of our development, it must be accommodated by the provincial legislation.
Chair, it is correct that we live in the real world. I think even from our engagement across the country in the past couple of years, it's apparent that the three spheres, we sometimes somewhat have different views on what and where the limits of our powers are. So you are correct, Chair, that you may have provinces that indeed will probably want to overstep. Just like you probably have heard the argument that even ourselves, we've been accused that in some instances, haven't we overstepped, haven't we become too prescriptive? And I think we've learned, and we hope correctly, from the judgment of the Constitutional Court in the DFA application around those kind of issues, and a couple of other judgments which have since assisted us in understanding this area. But yeah, it's a delicate balancing act that we keep navigating. I say to each other that we'll become wiser as we go into implementation. And probably some municipalities will continue to remain vigilant to then say when is a provincial piece of legislation overstepping its bounds and indeed encroaching on their constitutionally vested mandate. But how our view and what we propose in the bill is one which says the three spheres working in an interrelated and consistent fashion with each other. Yeah. The questions around the possibility of the three SDS and the three spheres and the fourth possibility of a regional SDS, it is in the nature of the constitutional allocation of powers. The national government must plan and its own sphere. Provinces must plan. SDFs, but at a very simplistic level and without, I'm probably not getting to oversimplification, SDFs is probably just a special expression of a plan at a particular sphere. Chair, it is indeed correct that it will not be desirable that if a province desires that a particular growth trajectory be pursued in this area of the country and the municipality thinks otherwise or national feels otherwise. The intergovernmental relations framework at assist us a little bit in putting in place a particular environment within which we negotiate this interrelatedness. What we cannot do, Chair, and which I think is a temptation sometimes, is to unwittingly get us into that space of seeing each other as tiers of government or levels of government, where we then say national will override the province will override. It's a particular tension, Chair, that the way we have deliberately expressed this in the piece of legislation is one which seeks to build on that negotiation and spirit of engagement as opposed to
to say that, I mean, Chair, we see this in probably three concentric circles where there are intersections where we all play. It's the same piece of land that we're all working on. It's not as if the municipality has got its own space somewhere and the provinces, we all work in the same space. So national will be able to express a view in that same space. Provinces will, and will continue to engage in this LC and very necessary constitutionally feasible tension of saying that what's the most desirable. The guidelines that we have proposed for managing municipalities and probably the guidelines that we're going to negotiate with provinces on even what the provincial SDF is and even the lengthy process that will result into a national special development framework are those that necessarily will invite all of us to be part and parcel of that development of those special development framework, and not that a municipality will go and develop its own SDF in its own corner without advising to provinces or municipalities. So, Chair, we will not have a scenario where you have SDFs which are clear-cut and look that conflicting. They would necessarily have healthy interactions amongst each other. Chair, maybe just a little bit around the question of Municipal Structures Act that Honorable Tolis and some of the comments have alluded to, around whether some things are regulated in some other legislation and we seek to regulate them. Chair, without going into too much history, I think the Fiscal Planning Act of 1967, the institution of guidelines or structure plans, even the predecessors to the Fiscal Planning Act of 1967, right from the aftermath of the Second World War, and what they were intended to do, without this Parliament having repealed the Act of the Fiscal Planning Act of 1967, and we still know that there are remnants of what the Fiscal Planning Act still authorizes your guidelines and structure plans, still in the law book. You had a DFA that proposed you have land development objectives over and above what you had. You had the Systems Act of 2000 that speaks to SDF. And in that same Systems Act, it says that when you develop an SDF, you look at the principles in the DFA. The Systems Act says that directly. Now we want to repeal the DFA. So what we're trying to point out, Chair, without going to long story, is the fact that these pieces of legislation, these different pieces of legislation, have always recognized the interrelatedness of their operations. The Systems Act gives you a shell. How you fill in those shells and the fuller details of those shells are different pieces of legislation in any event. So when you look at what is in an IDP and what it takes you to do an IDP, you will need to comply with different pieces of legislation. So when we talk about SDFs and our department regulating this mandate, as opposed to the Systems Act being overall and composing everything, Chair, we must not run into the temptation of imagining that system that was designed to cover all the fields. It was not. It has not, and it won't. So we're just pleading that we will necessarily see, and we'll be advised if there are those areas that colleagues can point us to the reality that this is how compliance with the MSA will lead you to a necessary conflict with what we have proposed in this bill. Chair, we see them as complementary and not contradictory. But to it does not directly address the argument that some of our colleagues are raising, that why are you regulating it into two pieces of legislation? Chair, that is the nature of it. When you make an application for a social grant, you need to prove ID is regulated in another piece of legislation. You need to prove other things. Laws are made in that fashion. We cannot have all of it and have this omnibus legislation which takes. What we should not do as national is to strangulate municipalities with too many regulatory regimes. So we hope we have not done that. Chair.
You still have eight items to attend, and you are really over-explaining.
Okay.
Just give us the principles that guide you.
Okay.
Remember that we do not want this record to be used in court against you.
Okay. Thank you.
We want you to deal with the time frames for reviewers. We want you to deal with the appeals internal and outside. We want to deal with the roles of councillors in the tribunals. We want to deal with the national interest. And we want to deal with the transitional arrangement and parallel systems. You have touched on parallel systems, but the rest not. Please, 10 minutes. I would have loved to give you five because we have other presentations here in front of us.
Chair, I think 2 seconds on transitional arrangement. We concede that what we have in the bill is not sufficient, and we will certainly work with with Parliament to indeed, we had indicated that the transitional arrangement, and because at some point the bill was meant to be passed before the expiration of the Constitutional Court judgment. So we'll come back to you and say that we've actually received well some of the comments on transitional arrangements, and we'll seek to strengthen that. Chair, on national interest and provincial interest.
What is your last sentence?
That we many of the comments around the inadequacy of the transitional arrangements in the bill are indeed correct, in our view.
But we should get written submissions in terms of how we should be structured.
Yes.
You will make a contribution, they will make a contribution as well, in that regard.
Yes.
Thank you.
Chair, on national interest. Chair, in this bill, we have expressly stated that all applications must be lodged with the municipality. All. Whether it has national interest or provincial interest. The primary land use regulator in terms of 33, clause 33 of the bill, remains the municipality. In terms of this bill, we have not totally beyond section 10 of the bill prescribed how the provinces will determine what are matters of provincial interest. But Chair, as I've stated, we all work on the same piece of land, national provinces. So we must relate. We cannot do it separately from each other. But what we are saying is that when national seeks to join in an application that is already lodged with a municipality, or call in an application that is already on a municipality, it will not do that willingly. It will be on certain criteria, explicit criteria laid beforehand. So the minister would not just one day imagine that, you know, the application for a mall in the city of Cape Town is of national interest. Or we hope that the criteria that this bill enjoins the minister to so do will not be one that will allow a developer to through sophisticated legal arguments, seek to locate everything as matters of national interest because they feel the minister would decide in their favor. So it's also one of those things that, of course, requires further work to be done. Chair, on the...
We agree on that one as well, that submissions must come in writing on that aspect so that we clarify that issue, because there is an impression here that national and provincial interests will, applications will go straight to those authorities. Now, your correction of that is that all applications go to municipalities. How the other spheres will interact with that processes of our application will be dependent on the nature of that application. Thank you.
Indeed, that's what is in the bill. Chair, quickly, on the question of repeal, Chair, there are two levels. We do concede, indeed, earlier drafts of the bill attempted to sideline and even address the question of other pieces of legislation that may have implications for land use management. Chair, you are correct. I think it's also about mandates and where does it reside. So at national level, we would engage with our colleagues further to say then that maybe lefty, maybe one or two pieces of legislation could indeed be brought in for repeal. Chair, what we cannot do and what we have not done is to propose that we repeal provincial laws. Chair, I think the lawyers would better advise us. There were laws which were enacted at national level before, which indeed were assigned to the provinces, which post-interim constitution, post-1996 constitution, have the effect of being provincial laws. Those will be repealed by the provincial legislatures themselves. National parliament will not repeal those. Those who are expected will be repealed by the provinces appropriately. Chair, on the question of five-year review, I don't know, and we must check it, the very early draft regulation that we're working with my colleagues. Chair, on the question of five-yearly review, our take of the five-year is one which suggests that the electoral cycle in this country is 5 years. We hope that we'll get to that mature level where whichever party wins, we all share a national vision as to what we intend in our space. But what we did not say, bring in a totally new special development framework after five. Chair, a review may result into do nothing. A review need not be very expensive. A review need not be done in 10 months. We suspect today that to develop a municipal SDF with public participation in it will require about 10 months when a proper job is done, Chair. Now, why should a review take more than 3 or 6 months at most? And why must a review necessarily be deal with the question of coming with a totally new SDF. So we are saying that a review does not necessarily entail the cost that is sometimes been suggested by the comments. So if you do a major review in 10 years, you may do a minor review or a tinkering in 5 years, and that's our view around the 5-year delivery. What we may not want is to have a document at this level of development, at this stage of spatial restructuring of our assessment, and looking at the legacies we are dealing with, that you have a document which sets a vision, and you only look at it for a review in 10 years. And
can I check with you as you add it? There are two aspects of reviewal in my own mind. There could be the desktop reviewal only on the basis of what direction of our development we're taking. But I don't hear nobody among the presenters here, including the municipalities, indicating that there could be a reviewal of your SDF when, one, the development is still keeping the old apartheid development route, two, whether the environmental sensitivity of the development taking place is ignored by the developers and municipality, and whose role is supposed to be that. Because the reviewal, from what I hear, is purely where the layout is and how it is progressing, but what about the content?
Chair, review should deal with all aspects of what you have in the SDF, both the longer-term portion that talks about the vision for 10, 20 years, both how you think you want to restructure your space, and all the elements of it, location.
Is it included in the bill?
Yes. Chair, we have clauses that deal with what SDF should cover. And when we talk about the review, we hope it's not just a tick box kind of thing, but one aspect that the review would look at those. But we are saying that assuming there is nothing, you want to start afresh, based on the guidelines we have, with a very heavy dose of public participation, a municipal SDF should be done in 5 in 10 months. So why should the review be longer? And why should we not have a review once in 5 years? And that's our proposal, Chair. Chair, on the question of capacity, Chair, I think it's been well addressed in some of the comments. We're busy with some work, and we hope that with the support of our principals, we'll continue to engage with municipalities where we think. And what we are not saying, Chair, is that every municipality will indeed have a one-size-fits-all kind of implementation of this bill. We're looking at quite differentiated and nuanced approach to implementation, and we'll forget that. Chair, okay.
Why did Cape Town take 10 years to create their own planning arrangement, as is claimed here? Second part is, Kevin is telling us that the SALGA process is purely on how to respond to the bill and not on how to prepare for its implementation. And you told us that you are actually doing that, almost like what the farmers call pre-settlement support.
Chair, I think we'll just have further engagement with our colleagues from Itikwini. Itikwini is quite a very big metro with a lot of capacity. Well, the metro there, without necessarily putting myself on the firing line, they are well-resourced, Chair. They don't know what we're even talking about when we talk about capacity challenges. So their issues are not on capacity.
But now you know that they need support.
We learn from some of them, actually, Chair. But indeed, we are working very closely with our provinces, and I would have expected my colleague. But the reality is what my colleague from Southern said, that there is a lot of effort in terms of ensuring that we address the capacity constraints in many of the smaller local municipalities. And hopefully we will get many of these metros to even adopt locals to support them as we go into the implementation of this legislation.
Just a little bit of information for the minister. The farmers that you see leave with the honorable member stay, they came to the committee to say the initiative of the portfolio committee visiting farms to look at the conditions of farm workers was a good initiative that they are encouraging for us to go forward on. They thought they would have an opportunity to engage with us on that matter, but we have been told that they have now recognized that we are busy on this bill, so we cannot do that, but we'll make a follow-up on that one with them. Go ahead, Sandy.
Chair, I hope I've addressed almost all the issues. Chair, there was something around interference by other spheres. Chair, we may not possibly like all of it, and we have not been able to read the Constitutional Court judgment on the DFA as one which says leave municipalities alone. It says respect them. Don't encroach on their powers. But it did not say we cannot regulate how they exercise their powers. And we hope that National hasn't done that. And we might have heard, Chair, that there are those feelings around why do we take the provinces of our bank from some municipalities. And of course, provinces, some of them have also said, no, you've only given too much power to the municipalities that see our provinces are not there. Chair, we leave the balancing act. I thought... Chair, I thought about saying the parallel system by saying that all applications will go to the municipalities.
No parallel.
Provincial legislation will certainly be consistent with this national law. They will not prescribe alternative processes. If there is a conflict, I think that the law is clear on what happens to it. Chair, on Section 62 appeals, maybe we need to concede that we may need to strengthen the bill in terms of excluding Water Systems Act in the effect of land use matters. Chair, on the question of involvement of councillors, we remain with our proposal that politicians should approve SDS, politicians should approve land use schemes, and politicians should approve all policy documents. The actual implementation should be under the guidance of and the vigilance of the politicians, as those powers of micro land use applications be exercised by officials and non-officials appointed by council. We are only saying that because of the possibility that those appeals will not be substantial, they may be entertained by the politicians themselves. In our bill, we have not proposed that they should be externalized to this, with respect to so-called independent appeal made up of private persons. We think it may be privatizing a public function too much than we intended. And that's our proposal in terms of that area. If the inter-municipal appeal, of course, is one that is largely composed of either politicians or people, but we think it should not be totally a privatized exercise of powers. Chair, I hope I've addressed most of the issues. If I haven't, you...
Maybe the presenters that came here have a better understanding of what is the thinking behind the bill and how it will be operationalized. And we invite those that made the presentations and those that did not to come back in writing about how that reading after the intervention of the department should be interpreted so that we do not define a law that will conflict with the department, which will conflict with you as well. We will rather make Parliament fulfill your wishes in this regard. Thank you very much, Sunday. We now have to move on to three more presentations. We did receive the presentation from Saldanha Bay Municipality, which is very comprehensive. And we'll welcome them to come back again here on the presentation in writing. They're here. But let's get the Griqua first. Did we get the Gauteng Provincial Department of Economic Development? Because they are listed here, and they should have started at 9. Nothing. So we will remove them. We now have the Griqua, and they will be followed by Saldanha and the Chamber of Mines. Can I get any indication as to the Chamber of Mines being here? Yes, okay. I like that enthusiasm, sir.
morning, everybody. Honorable Chairperson and members of the Standing Committee, allow me to the opportunity to convey the warmest greetings from our national leader, King Itat, living in Campbell, the Northern Cape. He's not here. He wants me to ensure that his spirit will be at this presentation today. It's very unfortunate that his health doesn't allow him to travel such long distances. On behalf of the Royal House, we extend our deepest appreciation for the opportunity to make a submission with regard to the bill itself. We must applaud Parliament for efforts to ensure public participation in formulating of legislation. However, we are very concerned about some processes at local government level which cannot unfold. As I heard now, the previous conversation and things, like for instance, if you take the IDP plans now with this management bill, according to the bill, they must be put together. Some of the IDP plans is for 10 years and nothing happened, Chairperson. So I don't know how will that work. We acknowledge the fact that we previously denied the opportunity to raise our concerns and objections. If you took, for instance, the Lands Restitution Act of 1913, it was not open, accessible, and was only in English. We hope this doesn't happen because a lot of our people haven't participated in these processes like this bill itself. As a result, it brought anger and disapproval in acceptance of legislation. Chairperson, we are also aware that our input should not only focusing on critics, rather addressing possibility or possible solutions. Together, we must work and love to develop a unified nation itself. We, the indigenous people, are coming from a history whereby our forefathers and parents were brutally abused, exploited and abused, and even humiliated by foreigners coming to our beloved country in the 1400s. By saying this, Chairperson, they were chased away from their lands, and land to us, not even the indigenous culture, to African culture is very important. When we talk about land laws and management acts, and we are excluded, it really feel we are nothing, because as a leader you are nothing when you don't have land, traditional-wise. They disturb, for example, the environment itself. Look, for instance, the Northern Cape currently, the solar panels issues. Two contractors have been awarded now outside of Africa without consultation of the public itself. And that's a major concern for us. If you look at all the access, the public participation, things like that, and nobody knows. We at the ground level, nobody knows. We only came aware when we visited a business chamber meeting, and now these tenders will be awarded to them without local communities being beneficiaries or nothing at all. Today's opportunity comes at a time when indigenous people are going to celebrate Heritage Day, to the effect that we demonstrate our culture and stimulate the debate on the existence of our tribe in a democratic South Africa. We must be part of our land use management systems because it means more to us than a life expenditure. If you look, for instance, we'll be a mine. Mine companies just come, do environmental studies, see there's, they find diamonds on there, apply for a license by the Department of Minerals, took their piece of land without your permission. That to us is a major concern, Chairperson. Because now that life exploration will only last for 15 or 20 years, but what after that? Digging out the grounds, nothing happened, like in the Namaqualand, in those areas, look what happened. Land is still there. Those people and foreigners, they enrich only themselves. But we, as the rural people, as the disadvantaged people in South Africa, gains nothing. It also came at a time after you amended the Indigenous Bill to effectively deal with the challenges of our people. Now I want to ask the Standing Committee, how will this whole Land Use Management System Act and the current bill that's now been in process to recognize us as Khoi and Son people within the traditional of how will that be in conflict with each other, because now there's traditional leadership and land also involved in that current bill. During our inauguration ceremony in 2007, we as the Griqua tribe adopt the motto, nothing for us without us. We further like Parliament to learn and understand our challenges we are facing daily. No assistance and open public participation at local and provincial level occurs. And I heard the discussion earlier on between you and the previous speaker. Chairperson, in local municipalities, it's about power. It's not about the people electing the people and developing the people or doing things for the people. Currently, like the previous speaker also said, we live in a real world. To understand us, people need to come out and live with us at grassroots level and see what we experience daily with local and provincial government structures. Because they don't consult us, they don't work with us regarding plans, development plans, or anything that affects us in the environment where we stay and live. Parliament also needs to establish whether the people of our country are the masters or the clients in development of bills. Because Parliament is the custodians of all legislative bills and everything has been passed to affect the people of South Africa. So I cannot see why there's an issue about local government, provincial government being fighting these kinds of things. While this bill, as it is very good. And really I applaud government for such thing. It's only those people at council level fighting and protecting now their territory, Chairperson. That is what it's all about. And talking about first-hand experience, as I said, if you took the solar thing now in the Northern Cape, it's about national against provincial and against local. But they forget about the people. How will it affect them? How will it change their lives? And how can they benefit? It's about the people, but to them it's about money and it's about income. A serious case scenario. The past taught us too many lessons on the development of an act which was enforced upon us. I heard the previous speakers as well mention about the apartheid regime never recognized human factors. The current government of today recognized everything. They changed us, especially with the Khoi and San people. Like 2 weeks ago when I was with the president itself, it changed. You mentioned one thing is we cannot be free. One cannot be free. If, like for instance, our ancestors that they stole outside, the buried couple of Greek couple, when we reburied them in Kuruman 2 weeks ago, it feels that they belong home. Just to explore our people being cut to see why we're living so long and these kinds of things and why we survive so long in the deserts. It's only for that thing. That's why we said, in apartheid regime, there's still a lot of acts currently. Like I said, I previously mentioned one was the Land Restitution Act of 1913, which excludes us at all for any land claim. Look, we as the Khoi and San had land before 1913, but with the current act of 1913, we are being erased, and we are a nation without existence currently in the Constitution. That's why we said we applaud the current government for what they did and what they're still doing. Compared with the previous government. A lack of understanding on processes in which our people address and develop and deal with decisions in our communities. It's only in English, Mr. Chairperson. The municipal chambers and the municipal seers and provincial don't advertise things when there's developments happening or when there's for local business people to develop themselves. So this is a problem for us. Look, if you look at the previous acts and laws, it's all in English. While the Constitution said you must be addressed or being helped in a language preferably which you are comfortable in. And this is the kind of thing that we really look. If you look at everything now on the internet, everything is in English. And for us, it's a concern because some of our people, 80 or 90%. Are not so educated or they're not interested in these kind of things because when there's public participation in hearings, it's only in English. And now they just sit there. They don't know that thing is really affecting themselves. You've been saying nothing or opposed nothing, just been there going for the food and these kind of things. A receipt of a failure or disaster is when Parliament is not learning and listening and interact with the people in order to develop legislation. Currently, Parliament is listening to our people. That is the one good point, standing out, because If not, we shouldn't have been here today. Worst case scenario. In the event Parliament fails to recognize and consult the following documents, we foresee a disaster in the implementation of regulation and acts as an international norms and standards. The Constitution. Look, when we talk about land use management act and systems, we must forget about our political appointments and moves. We must think about who elected that person into that position. So that person must come back to change the persons that it had them's life. Once we're dealing not with that in the Constitution, we're going nowhere, Chairperson. Also, the Manila Declaration of 1989, where we talk about participation and real actors of the thing, the Johannesburg Summit and Sustainable in 2002, the United Nations Agenda 21, 1992, the Earth Chapter Initiative, the United Nations Millennium Goals, and the new Biodiversity Act. I understand there still, Chairperson. The thing is, with the new solar energy things coming out to the Northern Cape, people forget about there's many indigenous plants that's also been used for herbs and these kind of things. Now they only think about the solar energy and the income that's going to be generated, but forget about these plants. With our many diseases not being cured, these plants can cure it. But been destroying now these plants, they forget or they clearly overlook environmental policies and studies and this new diversity, the Diversity Act, as I said, been approved projects and land used for things. That's why currently we said we agree with the bill, Chairperson, but to put two more powers into municipalities and provincial governments' hands. That's why we as people, as all the people down the line, suffers. Our recommendations would be, we would like to recommend to you, Chairperson, and the committee in Parliament, to consider and give attention to the following aspects. Apply to Chapter 4, I think it's page 29 and 30 in the bill. It lacks locally and provincially, openness in this regard, Chairperson. I just want to go back to the to itself. It says we provide clear and accessible information to the public and private sector and provide direction for investment purposes. Once you had, as the previous speaker said, in the real world, it doesn't happen like this policy and bill said. You will only find that things already happened. And you as the other person, you must just keep quiet. Because you are nothing. And I really differ to that, because every citizen person in South Africa has a right to these kinds of things. But it doesn't happen at that level. Include previously disadvantaged areas under traditionally reserved and rural areas, informal settlements, slums, and landowners of state-owned enterprises. Chairperson, if you look now, still with those checks and trust-on basis, those kind of things, it's apartheid systems that still we, when we look at these things, it brings back the what happened to our people or what it did to our people. We need to look away with that, with these kind of things, and really develop when developments come, when the Land Use Management Act will come into effect. It must also be effect, as you can see, it changed the lives of the people that stay in rural areas. It's no use when you approve a project or things like that and it doesn't change the people staying in the checks or rural areas. Okay, I'm really finished now. To conclusion, we confirm our trust in Parliament, especially for your efforts to ensure a public, private and transparent approach. Let us be both actors for real change in the lives of our people and make sure that they are priority in any decision we make. The indigenous people of our country should be treasured and sincerely appreciated because of our rich heritage. Therefore, we say together we can build better communities. I thank you, Chairperson.
That was the presentation on behalf of the Griqua by Mr. Peterson William. We are now welcoming the Saldana responded. Are they here? Like I said, they have given us a comprehensive written submission. I thought they were coming to highlight certain things in that submission. In that event, then let's call the Chamber of Mines.
Good afternoon, Chair. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, honourable members of the Portfolio Committee. It's an honour for the Chamber of Mines to be here. Unfortunately, the mining industry is going through very turmoil at the moment, so we are killing fires all over the place, but this is one place we wanted to be. So on behalf of my chief executive, his personal apologies because he couldn't be here today, but he's got other matters to attend to. But we are still privileged to be here and address the Portfolio Committee. Just briefly, the contents of our talk, we're going to just have an introduction of the purposes of our submissions, highlighting the role of the mining industry, why the mining industry is unique and needs to be receive special recognition, the importance of the mining industry in the South Africa economy, and then various aspects about how the mining industry was dealt with in the past and how it should be dealt with in the future. Before I go any further, I'd just like to introduce myself and my colleague. My name is Anton van Achterberg. I'm the head of legal from the Chamber of Mines. And next to me on my left is Professor M. O'Dale. He's an advisor for the Chamber of Mines, and he's from Norton Rose Attorneys, also assisting us. I will do the first part of the presentation, whereafter I'll hand over to Professor Dale. We've already thanked you for being here. The purpose are really to highlight, as I said, the importance of the mining industry, but we need to look at it in conjunction with our written submissions, because you will see in many instances we make a point which is referred to in our written submissions that were sent, citing the exact legislation we referred to and the authorities we referred to. So the two documents should really be read together. Just briefly, I think a lot of people underestimate really the role of the mining industry. People read things in the press, the mining industry doesn't care, the mining industry doesn't do certain things, therefore forget that there are a lot of positives in the mining industry. All the things I'm relating to now on your screen are for 2011. We created over 500,000 direct jobs in the mining industry, 838,000 indirect jobs in the mining industry. That means people who either get services from the mining industry or supply services to the mining industry. Given that every mine worker and mining job supports about 10 people, it means 13.5 million people in this country every day dependent for food on their tables through some job related to the mining industry. We account for 90% of GDP, a critical foreign earner, a foreign exchange. More important to note, we paid 17.7% of all corporate tax paid in this country, 26 billion rand plus 5.5 billion rand in royalties. So in total, the industry pays over 30 billion rand in taxes. We spend total 437 billion rand annually in the mining industry, of which 389 billion is spent in South Africa. So the significant expenditure happens in the South African economy. Also interesting to note, only 2.6% of our dividends, 12.7 billion, was spent in billions. Now you compare that, we pay over 30 billion to the fiscus, so it gives you a proportion that actually the government is much better off than the shareholders in the expenditure of the mining industry. We spent 89 billion, almost 100 billion on salaries and wages, which is by far our biggest expenditure in the mining company. Our social and labor plan spend, we have, in addition to that, the last bullet point, over 800 million spent on corporate social investment in addition to our obligations on our social and labor plans, which involve also corporate social investment spend, community development, and so forth. The point we're really trying to make here is the mining industry is the best industry place to help assist these job shortages and poverty alleviation in this country. So it is very crucial that in all decisions we don't unnecessarily negatively influence the mining industry because it has the potential to help solve a lot of our country's social problems at the moment. Thank you, Chair. I'm handing over to my colleague, Dr. Dale.
Thank you, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. We are on page 8 of our slide, Special Attributes of the Minerals and Mining Industry, and we do think that there are distinguishing features to the mineral and mining industry which don't apply to others. Firstly, minerals are area bound. The minerals are where you find them. You can't pick up your gold mine or your coal mine and put it somewhere else. It is where it is. So, for example, the coal necessary for power stations is where it is, and there's nothing more you can do about it. If you're going to exploit it, that's where you have to go. Secondly, minerals occur across boundaries. And the Department of Mineral Resources, the various regions have encountered that, for example, in Sasolburg, part of the resources in the Free State, part of the resources in Gauteng. You have it crossing Limpopo and Mpumalanga. You have gold reefs and platinum reefs which simply follow along. So mining doesn't occur really necessarily in one artificial municipal or even provincial boundary. Mining is in the national and economic interest of the whole of South Africa, as you've just heard in terms of the facts and figures presented. This, of course, links into one of the sections in terms of which the bill was drafted, section 44.2 of the Constitution, which talks about economic interest of the country as a whole. And it's also recognized as such in the Mineral and Petroleum Resources Development Act of 2002, which is the main mining statute and to which we'll return. Existing mining rights constitute vested rights in terms of Section 5 of the Mineral and Petroleum Resources Development Act. Rights are limited real rights in the mineral and in the land, so they constitute vested property rights for purposes of constitutional protection. Then one of the things with the mining industry is the unknown about it. It's fine if you see a mine there. What about all of the unknown geology, all of the unknown mineralization that still awaits discovery? For example, until recently, we didn't know about the shale gas methane in the Karoo. until recently, we didn't know about certain platinum mines, newer platinum discoveries. And of course, there's ongoing prospecting all the time. So it's very difficult to plan for things that you simply don't know are going to be discovered in the future. And then finally, under this heading, the MPRDA, if I can refer to it as that, the Mineral and Petroleum Resources Development Act of 2002, provides for pre-consultation by an applicant for a prospecting right or a mining right with the landowner, the occupier, municipalities, other state departments, that's other than the Department of Mineral Resources, and communities, as was highlighted in the Wenyama case of 2010 in the Constitutional Court. Now, as a result of all of that, mining historically has been recognized as a predominant land use. For example, in the old Mining Rights Act, you couldn't use land for non-mining uses without getting the permission of the mining commissioner in the form of a surface right permission. That was land proclaimed under that act for mining purposes. The Minerals Act of 1991 took over from that, and there too the Minister of Minerals and Energy was empowered to order cessation of non-mining uses, including inclusion of a town planning scheme if that was going to interfere with the objects of mineral development under that act. And then thirdly, even the courts regularly granted interdicts against non-mining development, including township establishment, which would hinder or prevent prospecting and mining. And I happen to live in Bryanston in Johannesburg. That was the subject of an early case, Transvaal Property versus SA Townships, exactly that. The court granted an interdict against township establishment in the hope that the gold reef meandered under Bryanston. Well, ultimately it didn't, and that's why I live where I do. But it's an example of the court interdicting other development in favor of prospecting and mining. As a result of that, too, there was special recognition of mining in old land use legislation. So what we are talking about is not new. We've really seen it before in the historical land use legislation. Firstly, now, of course, each province had its own ordinances. We'll deal mainly, or I'll mention mainly the townships, Town Planning and Townships Ordinance of 1986 of the Transvaal, as it then was. Firstly, no town planning schemes could be established on proclaimed mining land. Secondly, there was provision for continuance of existing uses for 15 years if a town planning scheme was promulgated. No township establishment could occur without the mineral right holder's consent, both under that ordinance and under the Development Facilitation Act. So a lot of emphasis, as you can see, on in land use legislation on protecting mining as being in the national interest. And then to continue on page 11, under the Development Facilitation Act, land development excluded prospecting and mining so that a tribunal couldn't deal with developments in relation to prospecting and mining. Similarly, under the Physical Planning Act, no physical planning permit was required for prospecting or mining. And then in 1962, in the Southern Johannesburg Regional Town Planning Scheme, there was an exemption for prospecting and mining, which led to a celebrated case called Falcon Investments, dealing with a quarry, Eichenhof Quarry, in the south of Johannesburg, where stone andesite was held to be a type of mineral and hence to be exempt from the scheme. So in fact, that quarry still operates in an area which is owned special residential, but because of that exemption, the quarry can continue. And we would respectfully submit that these old concepts really merit to be carried forward into the new legislation as well. Turning then to post-1994 South Africa, well, as we all know and as highlighted in the Max Sands case, national, provincial and municipal competences rank equally. Well, that's fine. That's the starting point. It's fully accepted. My
mining, however, is a national competence, both under the Constitution and then in the particular legislation which deals with the mining industry, called the Mineral and Petroleum Resources Development Act, in terms of which mineral resources fall within state sovereignty and custodianship. So again, all of this recognizes the national interest of minerals for the country looked at as a whole. So what we're dealing here, of course, is post-94, it's new thinking, and there it is, both in the Constitution and in the legislation. Secondly, an object of the Act is security of tenure for mining operations, that mining operations can continue unhindered, and as well as that, the objects talk about promotion of economic growth and mineral resource development, promotion of employment and advancement of social and economic welfare of all South Africans, and then providing for security of tenure. So those are national objects in the national legislation. As a result, the Minister of Mineral Resources is then empowered to grant prospecting and mining rights, even over residential areas. There's a section which we've mentioned in the written submission, section 48, in the MPRDA, in terms of which the Minister can decide, after having looked at certain criteria, even to grant prospecting and mining rights over residential areas and land reserved in terms of other laws. The Minister of Finance can raise a resource rent in the form of a state royalty, which he's done in terms of what we refer to as the Royalty Act. Holders of prospecting rights are entitled to prospect and mine and exercise ancillary surface use rights, because you need to build roads and have dams and dumps and offices, plant, housing, and so on. And conversely, then, surface uses which impede mineral development require the consent of the Minister of Mineral Resources in terms of the MPRDA. As the bill, the current bill actually states, of course, protections against deprivation and expropriation of property exist in the Constitution and, of course, then avail the holders of prospecting and mining rights. Now, having said that mining is a national competence, of course, mining must also comply with municipal and provincial legislation, but there is potential, though, for sterilization of mineral resources, for landowners to try to prevent rezoning for mining purposes, and generally for there to be detriment then to the national interest. The encroachments on mining that we foresee are twofold. Firstly, that the mineral rights, the mineral holder needs to procure appropriate zoning. Now, that was so before, but it was limited to urban and peri-urban areas, whereas mining largely happens in the rural areas, which were not subject, by and large, to town planning schemes. So now you have this wall-to-wall municipal jurisdiction, of course, under the new constitution, which means that now the places where mining activities occur are also fall within the ambit of the municipal and provincial legislation, which would not previously have been the case. So that's the first encroachment, as we call it. Secondly, land development by others for non-mining uses could potentially prevent mining uses. Previously, the mineral rights holder's consent was required, which covered not only existing operations and known future operations, but even unknown future operations, because the mineral right holder, whether or not there was mining, had to consent to non-mining uses. Now, conversely, there's no provision for consent, even of an existing mineral holder, let alone in regard to known or, more importantly, unknown future mining operations where there isn't a mineral right, a mineral holder, a mining right holder yet. What are our proposed solutions? Well, obviously, we would respectfully request suitable provisions in the bill relying on the self-same sections in the Constitution under which the bill was drafted in protection of existing known future and unknown future mining operations. The Chamber's proposed concepts to deal with this include the following. To first address what we call the first encroachment, namely now that the mining industry needs to procure a zoning of the land for mining purposes, there are quite a few suggestions and requests that we have. Firstly, either exclusion or alternatively recognition and accommodation of existing, known future and even unknown future mining operations in the bill, and secondly, a recognition then of national policies and national legislation in regard to mining and minerals, and that recognition would occur in all the parts of the bill which we've highlighted and which the Honourable Committee obviously knows better than we do, so we've listed those there. On page 17 in the middle, all the above aspects we would suggest should expressly exclude, firstly, prospecting and exploration operations because they are largely non-invasive operations and of short duration. So it would be a huge thing to have to rezone land to prospect for 1 or 2 years and then rezone the land back for other uses should mineralization not be found. The term exploration incidentally relates to petroleum, the term prospecting to minerals. And then secondly, that there should be an exclusion for underground mineral operations which don't use the surface. Obviously where there are surface structures, those would be governed, but the actual underground mining operations we would submit should be excluded, and I happen to see the Ikurudeni town planning scheme, they have an exclusion of that nature in their town planning scheme, so one doesn't have to zone for underground mining. Thirdly, we suggest that mineral holders should expressly be mentioned as competent applicants for land development, which relates to Clause 45. That's really just to clarify that mineral holders fall within that clause. The clause refers to any person granted a land development right by an organ of state. But in the McSand case, the court said, oh no, but the Minister of Mineral Resources doesn't exercise a land use planning function, and therefore we are just a little apprehensive that somebody might interpret this against us to find that we are not covered by Clause 45, and hence the request that mineral holders be mentioned expressly in Clause 45. The fourth idea under the first heading of rezoning for mining is that the transitional provisions should include a provision for existing uses, such as the 15-year existing use exemption contained in the Transvaal, the old Transvaal Town Planning and Townships Ordinance, which also gave a possibility of applying for a further 15 years, so that would give one 30 years protection. That's an operating mine. Then comes a scheme which doesn't allow for mining, but because you were in existing use, you can carry on for 15 plus 15 years. Fifthly, if consent is required for mineral operations, then we suggest that the consent should be in the lowest form. This would mean more to town planners than to mining lawyers such as ourselves, but we understand that there are grades of consent. There are things called written consent and special consent, which require consultation and advertisement and all sorts of things. And then when the word consent is used, it's really just a straightforward interaction between the municipality and the relevant applicant. So we would say if indeed we would require consent, that it should be the lowest form of consent. And then sixthly, under that heading, the problem of existence of mineralization not previously taken into account. As I said earlier, you don't know that tomorrow you find a brand new coal field somewhere in Mpumalanga or elsewhere, or in the Cape where so far we haven't had any coal, but you never know, the geologists are prospecting, they may discover something new. And we would suggest that that should be mentioned expressly as a site-specific circumstance warranting a departure from the framework or the scheme or the norms or whatever it is. So in recognition in general terms of the fact that in future a particular piece of land may be discovered to be mineralized. The second encroachment we talked about was land developments by others which hinder or sterilize mineral development or mining use. To address those, we have a few ideas and submissions which we'd respectfully make. Firstly, that land use schemes need to have the consent of, firstly, the Minister of Mineral Resources, who, after all, is trying to promote mineral development in South Africa, and secondly, of any existing holder of a mineral, of a mining right. I've used the word mineral authorization broadly. You'll see a very broad definition in the written submissions to catch all the different classes of mineral holders that there could be under the MPRDA. And that's, of course, nothing new because, as I've already mentioned, the previous land use legislation, even the current Development Facilitation Act, the current Transvaal Ordinance, which is operative in Gauteng and other parts of the old Transvaal and Mpumalanga, Limpopo, Northwest, provides exactly for that. If you want to establish a township, you have to have the consent of the mineral right holder. So we really just borrowing a bit from those to make suggestions going forward. The second suggestion is a prohibition on land use schemes in respect of land used for mining operations. Again, that's nothing new. It's found in the existing land use legislation. Thirdly, a cross-reference to the need for approval of the Minister of Mineral Resources of uses which could be contrary to the objects of mineral development, the objects of the MPRDA. That's dealt with in Section 53 of the MPRDA, which is quoted. All of these are quoted, incidentally, in the written submission, so I haven't been reading them out. It would take too long. But under 53, if one wants to use land for any purpose which may hinder mineral development, one needs the approval of the Minister of Mineral Resources. And we think that there should be some cross-reference, some alignment between what's proposed here and Section 53 of the MPRDA. On page 20, the next idea under that second heading about non-mining uses interfering with mining, we suggest, and this is in fact the case in post-94 constitutions, 93 and 96 constitutions, and of course legislation such as the MPRDA flowing from it, that mineral operations should be expressly recognized as being in the national interest, so that any land development, all land developments, need to be subject to referral to the Minister of Rural Development and Land Reform, who would then act in consultation with the Minister of Mineral Resources. Again, because of this problem that one doesn't know that today a barren piece of filth that nobody knows about tomorrow may be discovered as being the next richest platinum mine or gold mine or whatever in South Africa. And then thirdly, to address these aspects generally, not limited to the first and second massive encroachments as we've called them, to address mineral mining aspects generally, we would request express provisions that all the relevant functionaries in terms of the bill act in consultation with the Minister of Mineral Resources in all of the aspects covered by the bill. And secondly, we offer the possibility that the Minister of Mineral Resources be designated or delegated in the bill as the responsible minister in regard to all aspects of land development and land use which impact on mineral operations. We've seen that in the National Environmental Management Act, where the minister there proposes delegating the Minister of Mineral Resources for certain purposes, and that may just be a suitable vehicle here, using Clause 56 of the bill, which already empowers delegation of powers. Those are the concepts. We have, of course, in our written submission put forward drafting suggestions. I don't want to dwell on those. They're there in the written submissions. We respectfully request the committee through the department maybe to look at those. We also would I'm about finished.
Professor, you took 6 minutes more than I gave you.
Mr. Chairman.
And the municipalities here will think Chamber of Mines is getting preferential treatment. I wouldn't do that. thank you very much for
your
presentation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Chair. We appreciate the opportunity.
You stay for time for questions, but now we have Dr. Henning Stapelberg from Free State Coopta to come to the mic, please. Yes, go ahead. No problem.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and Honourable Minister, in the Free State, we have nothing for free, and unfortunately the roads are in a terrible state. But we've tried, and we haven't got mountains either. So it's a plain piece of land. I just want to explain where I'm from, sir. First of all, I just want to mention that since 1894, we've had central land use considerations and approvals. In other words, the Townships Board was established in 1894, and we're still working with the Townships Board considering all land use applications. That means the municipalities have never had any opportunity to process or consider, except for giving us comments on land use applications. They're all done via the Townships Board to the MEC. So the SPLUM is like honey to us. We've also experienced the old, and I doubt whether more than one or two people here would remember it, in the 1980s, the Sas van Tonder general piece of legislation, and just shortly after that, Christo Jonk also had a piece of legislation, but they were never processed further than the SPLUM. Something else we must just remember too, please, is that the way we understand it is that the municipalities have always had these powers. The Constitutional Court just articulated it and made them material and effective. But they've always had these powers. Now, if we look at the SPLUM, we've got a few general concerns. The major one is that it's going to be expensive and complex, and I'm talking Free State Province, to ensure that the municipalities will be able to process and consider and decide on these applications. We are in the fortunate position of having drafted up to a very final stage our own provincial legislation. As Tshwane is the biggest place, we've got the oldest legislation. We still work on an ordinance of 1969 and the Removal of Restrictions Act of 67. Furthermore, we have to keep these pieces of legislation and not repeal them, otherwise we can't do anything until we've got new legislation. So we're pleading, while some of the other provinces are pleading for more repeals, we're pleading for fewer, please, sir. Because if you repeal the Removal of Restrictions Act and Lefty and the Physical Planning Act, we're stuck. We can't do anything, not even as a centralized entity. We must also remember in the Free State, we haven't got town planning schemes on an edge-to-edge basis. Even some of the former predominantly white built-up areas are not governed by a town planning scheme, and none of the former predominantly black areas or farmland are subject to a town planning scheme. So we're in a very unique situation so far as that is concerned. We've also never had proper planning legislation. That's why I say the plum is like honey to us. It's forcing us to have our own provincial legislation, albeit that we are facing major challenges. The major challenge we are facing is that of capacity. We need literally everything at municipalities, from a waste paper basket to a computer. They don't know how to process these applications. We've got the mighty Metro Mangaung, but even they have only two town planners registered. So the other four or five they have aren't even registered town planners, including the head of the department. Then we also have only three other municipalities with, in the whole province, of 20 local municipalities, including the metro. We've only got four municipalities with town planners, and they are few and really inexperienced. Two of them have registered very recently, but they're young people. So what I'm trying to tell you, Chairman, is that we see it as a challenge, and our provincial act, or proposed provincial act, is, although working within the parameters of the SPLUM and trying to cover all the loopholes within the parameters that have been raised here, we are going into a totally new era. What we would like is for SPLUM to continue, and I know I'm not saying the correct thing now, for SPLUM to continue, and I haven't heard much wrong with SPLUM today. Yes, it needs attention. SPLUM does not fit us 100%. It does not fit our municipalities, smaller ones not even 60% at the moment. But it's something from which we can depart. So far as the Free State is concerned, we want to depart on a way of planning ahead and proactive planning based on SPLUM and our new provincial legislation. We also have problems with, and I'm not going to repeat what Swane has said very aptly and extensively, the different pieces of legislation governing SDS. I just want to add the regulations too, so we even have another piece. What could perhaps happen is that whatever is in SPLUM could be incorporated into the MSA or vice versa. It's a suggestion. It is a bit untidy, I think, for an inexperienced, I put incompetent in inverted commas based on inexperience, town planner or not even a town planner. Our smaller municipalities haven't got the funds for a town planner, but someone who works with town planning to look in three or four different places to try and find out what an SDF should entail. It seems a bit untidy, but if that's the way it works, then it works that way. Then one must train the people in that respect. Another major problem we have is with agriculture. Agriculture refuses to consent that we even advertise edge-to-edge town planning schemes. And now SPLUM says within 5 years we must have edge-to-edge town planning schemes for all municipalities. But I know, and I think some of the other people also know, that agriculture is going to put up a fight in this regard. I just want the committee made aware of this impasse, because for about 8 years now we've been struggling to do something with town planning schemes in an edge-to-edge basis. and we're not succeeding at all. They are denying us any motion in this regard. Chairman, we have indicated in a written submission, and with your indulgence we could submit it again and perhaps expand on it a little with more suggestions, not more queries, in next week or Friday when we get back home. But we can't see that Splum will stop us from doing certain things. And these things ought to be in the interest of development in the Free State, and I think in the Free State we need development urgently. So being a centralized province with all considerations and decisions, and now moving to a, call it a decentralized or a devolved method of doing, yes, we do face major challenges, time-wise, resource-wise, etc. But I'm the oldest in the company, so the younger people will take over, and I'm quite sure they will succeed. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. But I happen to know that farmers are law-abiding citizens. Why would they refuse the law to be implemented simply because they own those farms? Remember, they own those farms currently. In the future, they don't know. Look at the Chamber of Mines. They say the mines that they have now, that's fine. The future mines and those that don't know they exist, they want them to be dealt with in law as well. So the farmers would not want to ignore the law. I understand your difficulty.
And it's not the farmers. It's the Department of Agriculture. That's our problem.
Department of Agriculture is not running farms. The farmers run farms.
Yes, but they say it's agricultural land, and for that reason they will not allow us to impose a town planning scheme on agricultural land.
Department of Agriculture must abide by the law, like all citizens. So don't worry, the minister is here. He heard you. We, before lunch, we must hear, thank you very much, sir. We must hear Busa. Yes. I had hoped that Ms. Cosby was going to speak after you, but she's not here yet to speak on behalf of the farmers now. Not on behalf of the agriculture. Busa, we have a facility here. If you have any need for overhead projector, we have it here. And there's space for all three of you. All four of you.
Good afternoon to the chair of the committee and to the minister, I believe he's also here. Good afternoon to other representatives from various sections. Hey,
My name is Joan Stott. I'm the Executive Director of Economic Policy at Business Unity South Africa. I'll be presenting Bruce's comments on the Spatial Planning Land Use Management Bill, version B14, 2012. Overall, business welcomes the move by government to address issues related to spatial planning and land development. One of business's major concerns, however, which we also put forward in the NEDLAC process, is that SPLUM does not relate or refer to other legislation and policy within related fields of spatial planning and land use management. Some policy and legislation is still in the development process, which makes, which made the process of debating the bill in NEDLAC quite difficult. This creates a considerable degree of uncertainty and incoherence and only serves to add delays to an already lengthy process, but also serves as a disincentive, possibly, for new investment and development. SPLUM proposes very big and important changes to land use schemes without necessarily providing any level of commentary or supporting legislative framework for inclusionary housing, as one of the examples. And this is one of the shortcomings within the bill. For example, in 2000 and 2009, the Department of Human Settlements created a draft inclusionary housing policy framework, but this was not seen for a complete public consultation process and was never promulgated, so the process was never actually finalized. Business therefore recommends that the bill either not refer to inclusionary housing until there is a policy in place, or that it simply make reference to where there is a national policy in place. And in the areas of agreement at NEDLAC, we did manage to agree on including the definition of affordable housing and also to make reference to the national policy that relates to areas of inclusionary housing. But furthermore, business would urge that the national policy on inclusionary housing be finalized quite urgently so that there is little conflict or uncertainty around this area. And following the promulgation of the national policy framework on inclusionary housing, provinces should in turn, and again after a public consultation process, promulgate their own inclusionary housing policies, and which comply with the national policy but take into consideration any localized nuances. Furthermore, municipalities can only then include inclusionary housing within the integrated development and spatial development plans in line with the provincial and national policies. With regards to the issue around municipal councils and planning tribunals, business's argument would be that there should be equal representation between municipal officials and non-municipal officials on these executive authorities. And one of the main reasons is that it's critical that decisions around spatial planning and land use management are underpinned by professions, given that there is a limited capacity within municipalities currently. According to the South African Planning Institute, only 31% of non-metro municipalities have qualified town planners, and only 13% of municipalities have town planners as IDP managers. This is an impediment to growth, and poor decisions made by municipal authorities in such circumstances will simply result in burdening the court system, stalling or creating poor spatial planning and development, and negatively impact on an already stressed construction sector. A decision of a majority of members of the Municipal Planning Tribunal is a decision of the Municipal Planning Tribunal, and in the event of an equality of votes, business would argue that the chairperson have the deciding vote. A Municipal Planning Tribunal must also decide all applications or appeals without undue delay and within a prescribed period so as not to delay the development of land use areas. With regard to the regulations around these municipal authorities, corrective measures or procedures should be taken if a municipal authority fails to adopt or implement the land use scheme or establish the relevant executive authority as provided for in the Act. Timeframes within the land use application must be considered and disposed of by municipal authority, the appeal process, and the guidelines for determination of what amounts to an undue delay for the group. That goes back to undue delay in developing land use schemes and preventing those. One of the other national policy areas that business felt is lacking and should have been finalized before SPLUM went through this process is the national policy framework around development charges. This is an important and complex issue and has a significant impact on new investment and development. We are aware that National Treasury is in the process of formulating a development charge policy, which will provide a national framework which against municipalities can work and implement policy. Business is not opposed to the introduction of such a policy on principle, but it's critical that a proper process is followed prior to the formal adoption of such a policy, as development charges can place additional costs on building, and this then pushes up the cost of property to potential buyers of that property. As no national guidance has yet been provided to municipalities, development charges vary across municipalities, which creates patchy development, and developers tend to move towards areas where development charges are lower and therefore the costs of building are lower, where there are less onerous conditions. The unilateral imposition of such a charge further burdens an already stressed construction sector, as I've already mentioned, and could cause job losses or decline in development if costs to development become prohibitive. So therefore, a charge like this needs to be implemented in a balanced manner. And unless there is a national policy in place, municipalities will continue to attempt to impose charges at their own manner and discretion. This also causes financial exclusion, as I've already mentioned, to an undue increase in property prices, which pushes up inflation and pushes certain entrants to the market out of buying property. Business would therefore like to propose that where the bill refers to refunds of development charges, this rather be addressed through reduced tariffs by municipalities, given the time delays between payment of development charges and the recruitment thereof from municipalities. And within the NEDLAC process, we did find agreement on this area. But we would still urge that the national policy on development charges be finalized urgently. Around the application procedure and processes, in Section 26.5, it implies that the municipality may amend a land use scheme only if the amendment is in the public interest to advance or in the interest of a disadvantaged community, or to further the vision and development goals of the municipality. While this is generally accepted and supported, business proposes that the provision should also be made for minor amendments or amendments that an owner or developer wants to make and which do not necessarily impact on any other person, party, property, and are not in conflict with municipalities, IDP or SDF, or their development goals. Therefore, these minor amendments wouldn't have any negative impact. In terms of Section 28.1, the existing wording of this clause implies that the municipality may unilaterally rezone any land on its own accord. This is of concern in terms of the value of property rights, as this is of constitutional right and should be respected. So business submits that a municipality may only rezone land which it owns, or if a landowner, and that's in terms of the definition in Section 45.1, makes an application for rezoning, or if a landowner agrees that a municipality may rezone his or her land. So municipalities shouldn't be able to unilaterally rezone areas of land. In terms of property values, as I've already mentioned with regards to development charges, Sections 7A and 57 are of specific concern to business, and we would propose that these be amended to provide for a more balanced and non-threatening approach to an issue which can have a major and negative impact on new investment, job creation, and socioeconomic development in the country. In essence, as the wording currently stands, these sections give municipalities the ability to destroy property values, and this could have the effect of scaring away potential investors if they're not sure of the value of their property going forward. We
we do understand that the bill aims to support and promote spatial and social integration, but the bill does not specifically state that this will provide, that it provides for this. It doesn't, well, we know that the aim underlying the bill is to socially and spatially integrate the country. It doesn't make specific mention of that. And therefore, these sections could be used by one private interest to destroy the value of another without any concern for how it affects these integration goals. Business supports the need for integration, spatially as well as socially, but this needs to be managed appropriately and sensibly, and in a responsible manner which does not lead directly or solely to a diminution in value. And therefore would only have an impact on the municipal rate space, because any devaluation in land value means that municipalities can no longer draw those revenues as previously forecast. The context and location of any proposed development must be considered on its merits, and property value impact should be taken into consideration together with other factors, including social benefits, in order to ensure that the balanced approach is taken and the decision is made in this manner. It is noted that there is existing legislation which specifically and directly rejects such an approach, as stated in Section 7.1. And as the National Building Regulations and Building Standards Act states, a municipality may not approve any plan if such a plan will probably or in fact derogate from the value of adjoining or neighboring properties. And therefore SPLUM is in conflict with this. Finally, alternatively, business suggests the following wording to amend this conflict area. In exercising a power or performing of a function in terms of this Act, the authority will aim to minimize the impact on property values. And each exercise of a power or a performance of a function in terms of this Act will give rise to compensation from the state where property values are negatively affected, thereby including but not limited to where the reduction of value of property or properties is for the purpose of social integration. The decision must be made balancing the value decrease in the property with the social benefit and using the options or geographical areas where the net benefit will be greatest. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Ms. Scott. Ms. Stott, we have an arrangement where you stay for questions as well. We have four parties that will be enjoying that privilege with you. We've got the Chamber of Mines, yourselves, and the Free State Co-opter, and the Khrikwa. You can see that the mixture is not healthy for business, but it's good for COCTA because some of the questions might be deflected to you. And the Khrikwa will also be good in the mix because they are defending their land against you guys. Now it's question time. Honorable members.
Thank you, Jefferson. Mine is not actually a question, but just a concern around the presentation by the Chamber of Mines. Chairperson, if one may point out that some places were identified, or it was discovered that there are some minerals in some of the places, but which were not identified for mining at the time. What followed then was that in some prison areas, people were forcefully removed and relocated to those places where coal mines are to be found or to be mined. And the presentation, in the presentation, it has been mentioned that there is a wish or a will to sort of allow the prospectors to go and discover if any minerals were found in certain places. And my question then would be, Are we going to see again that people will be forcibly removed from those areas, maybe to or be relocated simply because there are mines on the area on those areas? My concern, the question is just around that because, you know, the areas down in KZN mostly where coal has been found to be in abundance, and people have come up, approached the local leadership to say they want to prospect, but at the same time they are saying they know that there are minerals in the area. Maybe could the Chamber of Mines maybe give clarity on those views around removing people from where they are currently.
Thank you, Chairperson. My first question is based on the Chamber of Mines, whereby they're talking of the land use planning contrasted with environmental aspects. Whether if they look at the bill, if I'm not mistaken, it's section 14, whereby the minister has to take into consideration all the any environmental management instrument that has been adopted by any environmental authority. According to their view, that clause doesn't cover what they are raising. Then the second one is on the issue of the Minister of Mineral Resources to be designated or delegated by the bill, because when looking at the bill itself, the minister will not be working alone. It will be working with the relevant or with the other ministers. So when looking at their comment, it seems as if they want the Minister of the Mineral Resources to deal with this issue, while the minister will be able to consult the Minister of Mineral Resources on issues that are related to minerals. Somewhere they indicated that if minerals operations do require consent, such consent should be of a lowest form of consent. What consent is that? Maybe if they can clarify that. The lowest form. What do you mean? Then the other one is on the issue of... they mentioned that... although mining is a national competence, mining must comply with municipal and provincial legislation, but there is potential for landowners to prevent rezoning for mining purposes. I think it's true because while mining is very much important, but also the public interest needs to be taken into consideration. If the public is being consulted and they have a different view, as Section 28, Subsection 2, 1, indicates that the public participation is vital in these processes so that at the end of the day, you know, there are no conflicts when there's development that is taking place. Then the concept of land development excluded prospecting and mining. Why do they want that exclusion? And also on the exemption, don't they think that Section 55, Subsection 2 will cover that because the minister can take a decision on what to exempt? Thank you, Chairperson.
Because there are no further questions, I put the question. And it looks like you are the only ones. Use any nearest mic, please.
Thank you, Chair. I will start and then my colleague can just add on where... sorry, I've not filled all the gaps. I think the first thing we've got to realize, we are not saying at all that mining must take place at the expense of everything else. It might be an impression, it is not what we say. What we really are saying is mining has got such important social and other benefits. There are vested rights of people with existing rights, so don't discourage or block mining unless there are good reasons to do so. And that is one of the things, accepted principle, that relevant and affected parties should be consulted. In this bill, no specific provision is made for consultation with mineral rights holders or the Department of Mineral Resources. That is really what we just need to see in that. We are not at all proposing, and we wouldn't want that, that in that process, other affected parties, including municipalities, communities, and so forth, the Department of Environmental Affairs and so forth, are not consulted and are not part of the decision-making process. As far as the Department of Environmental Affairs is concerned, there are specific provisions in their statute, and we know as we sit here the two departments are actually working out processes that they can amend the legislation to make it clear what is responsible for. I think that links me to the first specific question of the one honourable member, is forcible removals cannot happen in this day without certain legitimate processes. People living in houses have got constitutional rights, same as with mining companies have got constitutional rights. So all those rights need to be protected. If there is any conflict between such rights, there are statutory processes how to resolve those conflicts. So forced removals will not happen without due law process. The only thing is where for some, at the right level, a decision is taken that mining should take preference over another right. There would have been the right processes, right thing followed, and there must be an objective reason that can be justified and which can be challenged in a court. Because any decision these days is subject to the Prior Act, Promotion of Administrative Justice Act, where it can be taken on review. So, I mean, the process, the constitutional protection is for all parties, and we fully subscribe to that. We are not saying at all that mining must override any other rights. We must realize in future, normally where you have discoveries of mining, it is unlikely, or really it would be unusual that these would happen in existing township areas, because people exploring are not going to go and explore there and so forth. So it's very unlikely. In the normal course of events, housing developments and so forth normally follow the discovery of minerals, because we need to house our laborers, we need to attract other businesses to support. So there's normally a different sequence. We really should see it in the right context that these things happen. The point about the delegation to the Minister of Mineral Resources, what we have currently in the environmental legislation is there's a provision that the environmental issues relating to the mining industry can be delegated to the Minister of Mineral Resources. So we just raised that as one option. We're not saying we need to be done. The alternative is what we say, it should otherwise happen in consultation between the two ministers. But the point really is we are subject to environmental legislation and will be so. So besides the requirements in Plum, we still got to meet with all the other legislative requirements, and those ministers need to work out how they're going to deal with the matters falling within their two areas of jurisdiction between them, and we understand they are, in fact, in the process of doing that. We're expecting an MPRDA amendment bill later this year and some NEMA amendment bill, which we think will deal with those issues. I think the last point I just want to touch, the reason why we said the exclusion of the prospecting and mining from the requirement to rezone is just because prospecting and mining are temporary things and they're really non-invasive. So to go and apply for rezoning for mining purposes and then you prospect and then you don't find anything worth mining for, then you've got to go and reapply for the, again, rezoning to allow something else, just doesn't make sense. Remember, if the prospecting reveals any mineral, then a mining application would have to be made, which would then not be exempt. So it is just for those activities that seem to be of a temporary nature that we're proposing it, that almost the effort won't be worth it, the resources involved. Well, that is what it. I want to hand over to Professor Dale, just the one or two issues that's specifically in his area of expertise.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the first question, or really it was the second question then raised, Section 14, the National Spatial Development Framework must take cognizance of any environmental management instrument adopted by the relevant environmental management authority. Doesn't that not also cover environmental management programs approved in terms of the MPRDA? Yes, it does. But that's, of course, only existing environmental management programs. That's where you have an existing operation. What about, as we said, future operations where there isn't yet an environmental management program, or even worse, the unknown future mining operations where clearly nobody has even thought of applying for a prospecting right or a mining right or an environmental management program?
Please, Prof, I just wish that you enlighten us. The national development plan suggests both sector plans and a national plan. Now you're saying we should not plan for an unknown. We should exclude it. And when it comes to minerals, whereas the national development plan says we must plan for everything in order to guide development. We want to understand what you actually.
No, Mr. Chairman, I'm not suggesting exclusion. I'm suggesting accommodation and recognition of existing known future and unknown future mineralization. Your colleague, the committee member, raised Section 14F, that the national SPDF must take cognizance of any existing environmental management program. And I thought she was saying, does that not cover your concern, because if there is an environmental management program under the MPRDA, then the national framework must take it into account. I'm simply saying, yes, that's fine where there is an environmental management program. There would be an environmental management program where there is an existing mining operation, but there would not be an environmental management program yet where one's dealing with future operations for which an application for a prospecting right or mining right has not been made yet, let alone those areas where we simply don't know that there's mineralization at all. So I'm simply suggesting in reply, Mr. Chairman, to your colleague, that yes, that helps in regard to existing operations, but it doesn't cover the general concern that a national framework can never cover, or certainly unknown mineralization. And even in the specific circumstance, it does not cover future mining operations because there is no environmental management program. The second, I think, unanswered question so far, the question of the lowest form of consent, that's simply in town planning schemes, Mr. Chairman, where you know, you have authorized uses, and then you have uses that you can undertake by consent of the municipality, and there are certain categories there. All we are saying is if the mining industry does fall within that town planning scheme, notwithstanding our suggestions of exclusions and so on, if it does fall within the scheme, then the category of consent for which the mineral holder would have to apply to the municipality should be the lowest form of consent, which is really a consent between the municipality and the mineral right holder itself, rather than the more extensive forms of consent, which we understand go under the nomenclature, the name of special consent or written consent in these town planning schemes.
I'm getting more worried. The more I explain, I'm getting more worried. There's somewhere in the bill that talks about you could also go that route or not go that route, depending on the title deed, all the prescriptions in that title deed. I'm just thinking about the mining that is taking place in the international heritage site at Mapungubwe. Or Cape Town, the Table Mountain, the only known in South Africa, known mountain in a city. I don't know of other cities that have a mountain in the urban area. But then the heritage responsibility of the national government will insist in the national plan. you don't touch that.
Yes.
And that is why there's a hoo-ha about the mining at Mapungubwe.
Yes.
Now, what are you talking about, the lowest form of consent? Are we, the municipalities should be allowed to consent to mining?
Well, the
in that regard?
No, Mr. Chairman, the municipality wouldn't be the sole arbiter, as you correctly I would submit, say, that those things are governed by a national government, the national heritage legislation, even the mining legislation, which prevents prospecting and mining in certain areas like that. So this, where I'm talking about consent here, we are talking about ordinary, non-contentious land, not heritage, not special environmental. We are talking about...
I'm sorry, I really don't mean to be rude. You were not here earlier. There was a pointed question regarding the role of the national, provincial versus the local government. And the Constitutional Court specifically gives planning as a responsibility of the local. Now, all applications, therefore, will come to municipality, including mining, because the planning of that area would, your application will have to come to that local authority before it can be processed, even though they will process it in alignment with your minister that you prefer and this other minister. I still do not understand the lowest form of consent in that regard, because the municipality would say it will bring revenue to us, that's good, because then the property rates and so on. But how then do you exclude their role and prefer a minerals energy minister only because it's a national competence? So if you explain that, I'll be happy.
Yes. It's not, Mr. Chairman, an exclusion, as the Constitutional Court has said. The competences are equal and cumulative. So, for example, were the local authority to grant a consent use, that still would not allow the mining company to mine unless it had complied with all other applicable legislation. That was really what the Constitutional Court said in the reciprocal way. The fact that a mining right has been granted by the Minister of Mineral Resources doesn't exclude the necessity also to have the land zoned for mining uses by the municipality. Now, conversely, in what you were saying, if the municipality were to consent to mining, let's say on Table Mountain, because it wants to generate revenue, there's a consent use by the municipality. That, however, doesn't exclude the fact that the company that has now achieved that rezoning also has to obtain the necessary authorizations in the form of an approved environmental management program, has to comply with all the national environmental laws generally, which are definitely going to the National Environmental Management Protected Areas Act, would immediately say mining can't happen, even if a mining right were granted. There's in fact just a case called Sepaku versus Kranskopi last month, where Pretoria Court held exactly that. It said, well, even if the minister grants a mining right, mining still can't happen, because under the Protected Areas Act, if that particular farm were declared a private nature reserve for which the owner had applied, then mining can't occur. So it doesn't really matter in this context if the municipality grants a consent, because there's the lowest form of consent is required from the municipality. That doesn't mean that the mining company now does no longer need to comply with all the other things that would protect Table Mountain or Makumbugwe or anywhere else. Such, and the prime example is the National Environmental Management Protected Areas Act.
The mining company at Mapungu got it right, because that area is not supposed to be mined at all. I don't know how they got it right. But if we were to take your list of exclusions that you were talking about in the context of what you just said, how would it fit in the law? Because the bill as it stands now insists that the local authorities must do this work in conjunction with other structures, like you said, cumulatively. But also the minister has to exercise his own responsibility in consultation. consultation. So how do we then include what you're talking about?
Well, you'll recall, Mr. Chairman, that we said either exclude prospecting and mining or alternatively acknowledge it, recognize it, accommodate it. So really the, you know, the alternative situation, I think, is what you're suggesting is the more reasonable approach. That's fine. That is our alternative suggestion, and all the drafting suggestions that we made are in fact in line with that suggestion, simply to ensure the accommodation of prospecting and mining within the framework of the structures that are proposed to be set up in the bill.
Thank you very much, Professor. I really appreciate that. The honourable member asked for exclusion, but I think it's now been dealt with in the context of just the conversation we had. I'm happy with that. All right. And the public participation is covered by the law.
Covered, yeah.
That's right. Thank you very much. I have not asked any question, but I really feel there are areas that have not been dealt with. In the previous discussion on the capacity of town councils, tribunals in particular, there has been a collective view that SALGA, the metros and the department are currently handling both the pre-settlement, because this is what is happening in the Department of Rural Development, where a piece of land is given to a particular community, they must be prepared before they go onto the land and assisted when they get onto the land to be able to use the farm or the land. Now, in the context of this bill, the parties here said openly and publicly that that is taking place, but you still insist that that capacity should be increased by involving 50% of the people in that tribunal to come from professionals from outside. But we cannot prescribe that now because the responsibility of the town council. So how do we then prescribe it from the center? Because they complain about the prescription that we have now of officials and professionals. They say that it should be the responsibility of the local authority, not the responsibility of national government. And you say that you have discussed at NEDLEC. Of course, NEDLEC does not make laws for us. Parliament does. But explain to us, how did you get it right?
Thank you for that question, Chair. We had considerable debate at NEDLEC over this issue, and we recognize that South Africa is battling in a number of areas as far as the necessary skills is concerned. What we did is we reached a compromise where we reduced the need for those so-called skilled people to actually be qualified professionals. What we actually said... Sorry. So we actually reduced it from qualified professionals to people with the necessary experience. What we are trying to promote, Chachi, is a balance. What you don't want is a situation where poor decisions are made. That, you know, as explained earlier on in the presentation, it has adverse economic consequences that can result and does already result in bad spatial planning in our country and so on and so forth. So you want an informed professional decision to be made which is in the interest of the country. That's why we try to strike a balance between skills versus municipal officials, and that's why we actually were promoting that balance, that between the two, that at least you've got the necessary skills within the tribunal, which is essentially your appeal process as an individual. If I want to have something done to my land, I go to the municipality, it makes a decision. If I'm unhappy with that decision, I can go to the tribunal before I end up having to take the matter to court. What you don't want is to delay the processes. Already what we are seeing is that municipal residential development to get through the approval process at a municipal level is taking in excess of 3 years. What it's doing is it's adding approximately, and we did a whole lot of research in partnership with the Department of Human Settlements around this, it's adding an additional 25% to the cost of housing. So it's promoting financial exclusion. So you're trying to build a competence at a municipal level where that process is expedited, that informed professional decisions are made. That otherwise what you're going to find, you're going to find every second developer taking the matter to the courts, which is certainly not in the interest of our country, and it's going to put more and more developers out of business too.
My second question relates to everybody. I think SALGA and the competent municipalities will find it comfortable to deal with, because it's not a really rocket science. Many people have raised the question about the time it takes for an application to go through and the costs it adds to the development. What is the reasonable period for doing that to reduce the cost that will be ultimately passed on to the buyer? What is the reasonable time? I'm asking everybody. I'm asking KZN, COGTA, Free State, COGTA, BUSA, and municipalities. What is the reasonable time? And the department, of course. But although you did not prescribe the time.
Jay, the research that we did 4 years ago in partnership with the Department of Human Settlements and a number of its subsidiaries, we commissioned consultants by the name of RQ Group to go in on a pilot basis within the municipalities of Swani, which is a metro, as you know, as well as Mogale City, also a metro. Now, these are the more competent municipalities in our country. By rejigging the processes of an application and performance management within those departments, the turnaround time was reduced by more than 50%. I beg your pardon, Chair? From where they were previously to what they were able to achieve through the... Oh, sorry, Chair. The process was reduced to approximately 18 months. And it was more than half. Now, what happened is... the banking sector actually put aside 4 million rand for that project, and we wanted to roll it out nationally. There was no appetite at municipal level for this to be broadened. They just didn't have the political will to impose performance management on their employees. They didn't have the political will to continue to follow that process. What we did 6 months after we had done those two pilot projects, we went back into Swani and back into Mogale City, only to discover that they'd actually undone all the changes that RQ Group had actually implemented in those in those municipalities. And the when we approached the mayor in that regard, we were just shown the door. And that was the end of that initiative. Now, the Department of Human Settlements, about a year and a bit ago, has actually done a whole lot of work in that area in terms of trying to define the timelines in terms of that whole process. It hasn't made that a public document at this stage, but the old document was talking about approximately 18 months.
I think there is almost universal acceptance that we need to cut red tape, we need to reduce the regulatory burden, we need to ensure that bottlenecks on the way are removed. In the bill, Chair, there has been calls to say specify upper limits. But I think one of the things we all recognize is the fact that there are different types of land development applications. There are different scales. There are differences according to location,
and interests and even the capacity of municipalities themselves. So what we've done in the bill is to authorize that the minister would regulate so as to look at case-by-case kind of situations and not have a one-size-fits-all in a legislation, which then becomes difficult to amend. And we hope that with the kind of work human settlement I've done, with our continued engagement with the municipalities themselves, we'll be able to hold each other to performance standards and all those kind of things. Look at the norms and standards, look at the interrelated issues, and then prescribe more flexible time frames. But we are indeed in principle agreeable to put in time frames to dealing with the question of undue delays. And hopefully in the provincial piece of legislation, there will be those triggers that will be defined to then say when you are unable as a municipality to deal with this kind of matters, or you are unwilling to do it, or you have failed to actually deal with what are the consequences of those inaction or deliberate refusal. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for the opportunity again. I think Sunday is correct. The complexity that's associated with trying to set up time frames, I think it has got a lot to do with the scale of the development application consent and some of the triggers that those development applications might actually require with regards to getting the necessary permit from other sector departments. So maybe when we actually get to the level of dealing with our provincial legislation and the regulations, that issue of time frames can be actually addressed, taking into account the specific context and the nature of the development application that one is talking about. So it would be very difficult to actually come up with a definitive time frame that says for development applications, these are the sort of time frames that we are looking at.
I'm assuming that the cities are agreeable. Well, why did you rejig the already rejigged the process twice a year when you were capable of changing the process from 36 to 18 months? What's going on? What's the problem? Before you answer, in my previous life, I was dealing with some things closer to this thing. The biggest problem, the facilitators, the people who want to walk the document through the municipal system, they demand more money from the developer as the in between player, between municipality and the developer. So the more the delay, the more desperate the developer gets, and the more money they are prepared to pay. So there is a speculation and manipulation in the system, which is sometimes neither in the hands of the municipality nor in the hands of the developer. In order for us to get rid of those roles in the law, Sunday says let's leave it to the regulations rather than in the law itself. I don't know whether, Sunday, you are right. Let's hear from the municipalities and COGTA.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Marley Pilafasa from the City of Tuani. It is very difficult, I think, as Sunday, as well as Max already indicated, to put a specific time frame to any particular land use application or even land use application type, because it differs so much in terms of complexity.
Are we not talking about the average time rather than prescribed time? Can't we deal with average time?
Thank you. We can talk about average time. The average time for township establishment application can take 18 months, as already indicated. The average time, for instance, for rezoning application can take anything from 6 months to 18 months, depending on the certain circumstances. And I think everybody that has worked in local government knows that. You receive an application, and then you receive, for instance, objections that you must need to resolve. There are so many dependencies that influence the time frames that a land use application, how you can deal with that. The other difficulty is that from a Tuani perspective, some time ago I did an analysis of what was the stumbling blocks that prohibit us in finalizing land use applications faster and quicker. And what was interesting, and that is partly our problem with how the proposed provincial legislation currently is being drafted, is that an application are being submitted, and although we have a requirement that it should be complete and full, that we do sit with the situation that we are dependent on information from the applicant side as well. Now, the applicant sits with the problem that they are, again, dependent on getting a ROD or other information. So there's a lot of dependency chains, if I can call that then hinders the processing of a land use application. We have now gone so far, for instance, in the City of Tshwane's instance, that we have now entered a arena where we are currently refusing land use applications based on the fact that the applicant don't bring us the necessary documentation. Now, the current legislation, or the proposed legislation rather, compel the local authorities to comply with specific legislative timeframes. But it doesn't also compel the applicant to do the same, that we say that once he hasn't complied with this and that and everything else in this particular time frame, his application is actually lapsed. It doesn't say that. So we're sitting with a lot of applications on our table, which just doesn't move. It's a lot of work that bogs the system down. And that's the problem when you deal with the processing of land use applications. We also sit with the problem that some municipalities took the resolution to approve a land use application before the necessary information wasn't there. So then to say that we process or finalize the land use application fast, but there's a lot of red tape that must be done afterwards, is a fatally flawed picture, because it doesn't really take the timeline until it's promulgated. The same was true with all the DFA applications. It moved very fast through the initial process of even having a tribunal resolution. But the aftercare, in terms of the timelines, was also very slow. So it's good to criticize the current process, but some other legislation wasn't as enabling as some people like to think it is.
Explanation. I never worked at a local government level, so I wouldn't judge you for that. But maybe we should stick with Friday, Sundays. We stick with Sunday's view on this matter. But we're dealing with averages. We are not dealing with absolutes. Thank you very much. Yes.
Chair, if the Chair so wishes, the research and all the findings of RQ Group I could make available. It does represent a best practice. You know, in those two metros that I was referring to, you had some officials where a piece of paper was going over their desk 13 times. That's how bad the processes were. And that maybe that work can be used to actually create a best practice nationally, a guideline. They actually created a manual, Chair. That manual could actually be rolled out nationally for municipalities to take into consideration.
Thank you, sir. I think Sunday would require that document, because they are the ones who would want to use for the regulations, because we want to keep the flexibility in the law. Remember, we had agreed collectively here that this is a framework act. It's not supposed to be prescriptive. Thank you very much. I see a hand behind you, Sandy.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. It is from the City of Johannesburg. Just to concur with Tshwane, is that these processes, they go through three distinct phases. And then the first phase is where you submit an application, you circulate it, and you have to compel people to comment on those applications and so forth. And those things are currently legislated in terms of time frames. And those processes can be managed in terms of that. But then an application goes into an evaluation phase. And that is where you have to technically assess the application, and you have to consult with all the service departments, and you have to consult with all the various departments at the provincial level, and even in some cases at a national level. Now you have to you've got their comments, and now you have to engage with them to find solutions for your application, the development application. That takes its time, and that's very difficult to legislate a specific time frame on those things. The comments that we've raised was is that we agree that the efficiencies can be managed and should be managed within local authorities. And there are a lot of inefficiencies as a result of a lack of information, a lack of capacity sometimes, a lack of the necessary skills and so forth in the various local authorities. But if you legislate that, it means that it creates an opportunity where an application can be escalated from the local authority level then to a higher authority of decision making, which then adds to the problem that we've raised before, is that decisions can then be taken at a higher level. And we have concerns in terms of how that process is sometimes manipulated by developers and applicants in order to get to that particular level. Now, as I said, that's a very complex phase. It's the second phase. The third phase is the one that Swanee has also alluded to, is that is where you have approved an application, you've laid down various conditions. Conditions of supplying services, providing the necessary services to an acceptable standard, cancellation of certain rights that are attached to the properties and things like that. Those things have to be complied with before a final clearance can be issued to say that we can allow that township to proceed or the transfer of properties can take place. That process is not dictated by the local authority. It's dictated from the outside. It's by the applicant. He submits his division, his evidence of when he has complied with a certain condition. But that doesn't mean that he has complied with all the conditions at the same time. So it takes time, and it's also very difficult to legislate the time frames for those things. We are very responsive in the final phase in terms of what gets submitted and what we can sign off and accept and say that this has now been complied with. What about the other conditions? So that's just a general sort of explanation in terms of the different phases and how difficult each of those phases are in terms of specific time frames. Thanks.
None of you have dealt with if all the reasonable documentation is available and the developer has applied and everybody has commented. But then the people who must take the final decision do not sit. The council does not meet. And all the officials have dealt their work. What is then the right of the applicant? Where can the applicant go? Yes, Free State.
Chairman, what we've done in our proposed provincial legislation is that for undue delay, and then we define undue delay, the applicant can appeal to the appeal tribunal.
Thank you very much. I'm raising these questions deliberately Sunday so that when you draft the regulations, you don't leave this matter for other people to do. You remember then there was a concern that the applicants can choose to come to the municipality or to the other or appeal even before the final decision is taken, appeal to the other authority. To close those loopholes, we have to make sure we have one streamlined process. Yes, Sunday.
I'm not directly responding, but I just want to highlight something that my colleague from City of Johannesburg raised. Chair, in all our sites for solutions, so what exactly triggers another level when a primary decision maker has failed or is unwilling to take a decision? Some of the discussions at NEDLAC tended to say, legislative, let provinces deal with it, like Dr. Stepperberger just stated, or appeal. The challenge that must be still, that we must deal with, is to manage a sequence where you don't unwittingly create a scenario where people are actually interested in that second layer, not the first layer. So they make everything possible to ensure that the first layer itself is not adhered to, or there's some delay, engineered delay. So
so that, and that may also implicate how we ultimately see either a municipality being taken off its powers, especially if that appeal leads to a body that sits outside of a municipality. And that, for me, is a critical challenge. So that you say, okay, municipality, if it fails or is unwilling or unable to perform this function, a developer shouldn't be left without any option. But what then when it has been engineered to deliberately create the municipality to lose its primary function so as to go to a different level? And that's where the challenge around whether or not you even have people who are not municipal officials sit at the next level, or that next level is a provincially established body, or who establishes it. Because ultimately, we may find ourselves in a scenario where municipalities are undermined. Thank you.
No, I agree with the last part, but I'm sure the minister would share with this meeting that we know the fact that there can be undue delays, not necessarily from the municipality, but other authorities as well. And there is no remedy in this bill about how those developers could take action to get the remedy. Let's use the example of the runway in the Port Elizabeth airport. The application was done when the cost of that runway was 1 million rand, and nobody really did anything about it. Currently, the price is prohibitive because nobody took any action. The municipality wants it, AXA wants it. No authority is willing to take action. And if the bill would make provision for somebody else should be able to take action so that it triggers somebody to do something about it, then the remedy will be there in the law, but currently it is not. So maybe you should look at it and see whether the time frames should not be jigged in a way that will give remedies to other parties as well. I must say it openly in this meeting that you have situations where municipalities are actually completely dysfunctional. They are fighting among themselves, and the officials are pulled that way or the other way. What happens to development in the town? So if there's no law that protects the developers, you have a problem. Can we move on? Yes. Oh, yes. KZN.
I just wanted to share what we've done there, and it's gone around quite a bit. The biggest problem there is our constitutional powers are so limited to do something about it as a province, if it is non-adherence to time frames. I'm not going to go through all that we've done. All the time frames are benchmarked against certain times, and there are maximums that you can, by mutual agreement, extend, but there are limits to all of that. But in terms of just a final point, absolutely agree with Sunday, and you don't want to issue a appeal body, whichever form it takes, to start hearing applications in the first instance. So our latest suggestion, which we're looking at, which we probably will go for, will be, which we agreed on in a recent workshop, is that within a certain time frame, the applicant must get a mandamus from court to compel the municipality to take a decision. If they don't, within that period of time, take action themselves in the application lapse. We cannot have applications that are 10 years old, 20 years old in the system which we've had due to no decisions being taken, and then the applicant themselves then take a matter further either. So that's how we set things up in KwaZulu-Natal.
Thank you very much, KZN. I appreciate that. We now have to move on. Unfortunately, we do not have any further questions. So you are free, Professor. I didn't say you're free to go. We have three presentations now, last presentations. We have AgriSA, Community Law Center, the Western Cape Government. Those three. Sunday?
Yes. I don't want to confirm. I don't have talent.
What? What is your question?
Whether those three presentations will be taken after lunch.
Oh, you're proposing a comfort break. Okay.
Let's take a comfort break for 30 minutes.